Good morning, everyone. Welcome to session 5 of the course on the ethics and regulation of clinical research. I wanted to take, since we're halfway through the course, I wanted to take a moment to remind you of a couple of things. One, of course, if you're interested in credits for this course, make sure you sign in and turn in your form that you've been here at the end of the day so you get the credits that you want. That's important because that's what the credit granting agencies require of us. Second thing, I wanted to take a moment and remind us all that this is a course where we raise controversial issues, and we do so intentionally because that's what ethics is all about, which means that you're not going to agree with every speaker that you hear. It would be a shame if you did agree with every speaker that you hear. The idea is to get you to think, to provoke you to think about what the issues are, how to argue for and against them, how to understand them, so that when you confront issues in your own work, then you can have some sort of background to fall back on. So I think it's important to remember, I think Zeke even started with this the first day, even those of us who do this sort of for a living don't agree with each other. We have varying interpretations of different situations, and we have different arguments to bring to bear on certain situations. So all of that is important in terms of really thinking through and learning the ethics. Hopefully you're getting something out of the reading as well, and hopefully some of the sort of the practice mock IRB was a way to sort of test some of the ways that you think about some of the issues that we've raised thus far. So today we're going to tackle two topics. One is risks and benefits, and as you know, risks and benefits have come up throughout from the very beginning, the very first day, every discussion that we've had. And so this morning we have with us Dave Wendler, who is a philosopher who works in the Department of Bioethics here at the Clinical Center, who's thought a lot about these issues of risks and benefits, and I think you're going to find this a very interesting discussion. So, Dave?
Good morning. This is on. So I'm the poster child for you shouldn't believe and agree with everything you hear at these talks. And so Christy was just preparing you for me just to make sure. I don't think I've ever given a 45-minute talk that everybody should believe everything I say, so you should at least be prepared to realize some of this you shouldn't believe. Also, I hope this works, but I'm going to try to go through what I think are the major components of doing risk-benefit analysis in a 45-minute talk, which is going to end up being, I think, a fair amount of material and a fair amount of work for the people who are here and awake this morning. But let's see how it goes. And what I'll try to do is get through it so we have time for question and answer. So maybe some of the question and answers may just be clarificatory of things that I don't get clear. So I'm just going to start with an example just to set the stage for thinking about risks and benefits in clinical research. And this is taken from an actual study that is ongoing right now. It's a multi-center study. I varied it just a little bit for our purposes, but it's essentially a real study. And this is a study of a relatively new drug, P, which shows broad activity, which suggests that it may inhibit angiogenesis and tumor growth. So for people who don't know, this is a new thing, relatively new approach, I guess, in oncology, which is rather than try to kill the tumor, what you do is you try to cut off its blood supply so that it doesn't grow anymore. And the idea is even if you have the tumor in your body, if it's not continuing to grow, hopefully it won't pose increasing risks to your health. So the goal of this, sorry for the abbreviations, I was trying to get all this on one slide, but it's basically a pharmacokinetic study. So they're trying to determine the maximum tolerated dose, so they're just going to increase the doses across subjects and the dose-limiting toxicity. So that just means they're going to try to see how much of this drug they can get into people and what is it that starts happening, what bad things start happening to them, which prevents them from getting even more of the stuff of P into patients. And they're going to try to characterize the pharmacokinetic and pharmacodynamic profiles of P. So basically they're going to take some blood, see what blood levels of this drug do when it gets to its peak, when it gets to its trough. And we're always optimistic, so although this is basically a phase one study, they're going to document any anti-tumor activity that they see in any of the patients they enroll. So if they see some interesting, promising results, they'll at least document that. So P has been given to a small number of patients in the past with renal cell cancer, and although it was a small number of patients, there were some encouraging signs. Furthermore, in that set of patients, P appeared to be well tolerated, although there were some adverse events, some hypertension, diarrhea, nausea, fatigue, and a little changes in hair color, but not significant enough adverse events that they don't think the drug is promising. So for this study, they're going to take all comers, basically anybody who has a metastatic disease for which either there isn't standard treatment or the standard treatment is no longer effective for the person in question. So basically they're taking people for whom this is the last potential option. One of the questions, obviously, I don't know whether they want to consider it a treatment option since it's a phase one study, but either this is their last treatment option or this is in people who don't have any treatment options, and they're going to exclude people who don't have adequate renal function or bone marrow function, just to try to minimize the risks, at least in this early stage of the study. So the people who enroll in it are going to get P orally once a day for 21 days, and the dose escalation is across subjects. So there'll be a set of subjects who get a low dose, and then if that all goes well, then the next set of subjects will get a larger dose, and then they'll just keep increasing the doses, keep enrolling groups of subjects until they get to the point where there's some dose-limiting toxicity, people can't take it anymore, and they have to stop. And then finally, every day they're going to take some blood. As I mentioned, this is for the pharmacokinetic part of the study, so they're going to take some research bloods every day to evaluate how P behaves in the blood of people who have metastatic cancer. Okay, so in large part, I didn't present this because I think it's some odd or unusual study. This is supposed to be a fairly standard paradigm example of a phase one clinical research study, at least in oncology, and it's supposed to highlight this, what I think is central ethical dilemma, which you guys have been focusing on for this course thus far, which is basically, as I take it, the question is, when is it acceptable to expose people to research risks such as the risks in the study? So one of the risks is you're going to be drawing blood every day, not for the benefit of the people in the study. That's for research to figure out things about this drug that might be beneficial in future studies for future patients. So how can it be acceptable for investigators, or if you want to make the question even more charged, how can it be acceptable for nurses and physicians who are at least typically charged with doing what's in the best interest of the patient in front of them, how can it be ethically acceptable for them to do these needle sticks, withdraw blood from these people with metastatic cancer in order to help other people, not in order to help the patients in front of them? So the general answer, which we could talk about more, I'm not going to talk about very much. Hopefully, at least some people have been convinced by this now, is my general answer is it can be acceptable when their participation involves two things, contributing to an important project and the risks of participating in the study are not excessive. So I'm not going to talk much about the important project here. The goal here largely is going to be to think about the risks and when are risks excessive or not to research subjects. So if that's the right answer to the ethical dilemma, then it suggests that evaluating, shouldn't be surprising to most people, that evaluating the risks and benefits of clinical research is incredibly important to ensuring that it's ethically acceptable to do it. And what that means then is we have this challenge, at least those of us who do research ethics, of trying to develop a framework that IRBs, funders, investigators, and others can use to evaluate the risks and benefits of clinical research. And what's surprising to me when I started thinking about the ethics of clinical research was there was essentially no systematic framework for doing this, despite the fact that we've been doing it for a long time now, and it's an incredibly important job. So what I'm going to try to do is describe a preliminary framework that I've come up with, and I'd be very interested in what you guys think about it. Okay, so couple things to think about in setting up a framework. The first thing is what a lot of people in the literature call components analysis. And basically, this is just to make the point that, as the example of the study of P illustrates nicely, clinical research studies typically involve a number of different interventions. So that one had visits to the clinic, it had blood draws, it had administration of the drug. So there are a number of different interventions or components that make up the study, and the assumption is that at least initially, in order to evaluate the acceptability of the risks and benefits of the study as a whole, you should start by evaluating the acceptability of the risks and benefits of each of the components that make up the study. And we'll talk about, I think there's some interesting questions that arise when you talk about evaluating the risks and benefits of individual interventions versus the whole study, and we'll talk about those as we go along. I think that's where some of the interesting challenges come. Okay, so brief background for setting up this framework. This is a fairly standard way, I think, of thinking about benefits and harms. So benefits and harms are experiences that advance an individual's interests. So I think of interests in a very broad, simple way is basically your interests, things that are in your interest are things that are good for you, things that make your life go better. So benefits are things that make your life go better, things that make for a better life for you, and harms are essentially the opposite. The things that either set back your interests, things that make your life go less well for you or less well for the patient who's involved in the study. So those are benefits and harms. And then we get to, typically we can't be sure, particularly in the research setting, that we'll hurt somebody, hopefully, or that we'll even help them. Instead, we're dealing with potential benefits and risks. And potential benefits refer to the chance, given some intervention, given some set of circumstances. So given that we're going to give you P orally once a day for 21 days, what is the chance that that may help you? It may freeze your tumor. It may get your tumor to shrink. And then risks are the chances of harm. What's the chance that that's going to lead you to be nauseous, that that's going to lead your hair to change color? And I won't go into this very much. I'm just going to leave this in the background unless people think it's important specifically to talk about. But when you start thinking about potential benefits and risks, you realize they're fairly complex. So some of the things you have to think about is if there's going to be a harm, so your hair is going to change color or you're going to be nauseous, it's not clear yet how bad that is until you know some things about the experience. How long is the nausea going to last? Is it going to be an hour or is it going to be a month? Is it going to be mild nausea or are you going to be throwing up five times a day and get dehydrated? So you need to know a lot about these experiences in order to figure out exactly what the level of potential benefits and the risks are. So here's the proposed framework I have based on that background analysis. It involves six steps for evaluating the risks and benefits of clinical research. And we'll go through each one in order as we go through it. So I won't go through it right here on the slide. I'll just give you a second to read it, and then we'll go through them one by one. So the first one, and this is something that you've heard from the beginning, I think, when Zeke gave you the proposed framework for the ethics of clinical research, and the argument we try to make, I think maybe this is one of the few things we agree on in our department, is in order for research to be ethical, the first question you have to ask yourself is whether or not the research is valuable. If there's not value to it, if it's not a valuable study, then there's no point in doing it, no matter how low the risks are. Even if it's just one blood draw, if it's pointless, then that one blood draw is unethical. And I won't say much about this, except to say that I think that this is probably the point at which in clinical research, we probably make the most mistakes. So my experience being involved in clinical research now and the ethics side of it for about 14 years is that IRBs, investigators, institutions, by and large, are very good at worrying about risks, minimizing risks, protecting subjects from risks to the extent that they can. But I think that we don't do nearly as good a job of making sure that the study is scientifically important, that the study is something that has social value, that's worth doing. I actually think there are deep reasons for that we could talk about if people are interested. But at this point, I just want to highlight the importance of this and also the importance of having the right people to make these judgments. So I sit on an IRB, but if I were presented with this study, is this a socially valuable study to do of P? I have no idea. I don't know a lot of things you'd need to know. Well, what other drugs are there that might inhibit tumor growth? How well are they working? Are they great? Don't we have enough of them? How much is this one going to work? How many tumors might it work against? So there are a lot of questions you need to know, and you need to know a lot about cancer, drug development, in order to answer those questions. So you need to have the right people making these judgments as you go along. That's the first lesson, I think. The second lesson is to identify the components. So that's the components analysis part I talked about. You figure out what the different components are, the blood draws, the administration of P. Let's just imagine those are the two for the purposes of this study right now. So what you do is you identify each of the components, and then you ask yourself, what are the risks of subjects undergoing or experiencing each of those components? So what are the risks of the blood draws, what are the risks of the administration, daily administration of P, And the point that people try to make is that when we think about risks, it's fairly natural to think about physical risks in clinical research, but there are, at least in some cases, other kinds of risks, even economic risks. A person has to miss work, or a person gets such bad nausea that they can't work for a week after the study. There might be psychological risks. There might be social risks. People talk about social risks a lot in genetic research, where maybe there's a possibility of stigma of a group if you find out that a particular group is more at risk for certain diseases than other groups. And for the most part, I think this is another mistake that a lot of IRBs make, is that we're focused on the ethics of research here, but it's important to notice that often clinical research studies involve a mixture of standard clinical interventions and research interventions. And for the most part, when you're evaluating the risks and benefits of research studies, you should be focused on the research components of the studies. The assumption, at least, hopefully this is typically valid, is that the clinical care components are validated, that they make sense, that they're in the interests of the subjects. So that leaves the question of the purely research intervention. So in this case, the blood draws and also the administration of pee, which is not indicated or approved drug. So you focus on the research interventions. Okay, so to evaluate the risks of these studies, obviously one thing you need is you need to know a lot about the impact of them. And I think this is one of the great challenges for IRB. So we have this example of pee. It's been given to very few human beings. But what the IRB is charged with is saying, okay, are the risks of pee to human beings excessive? And that's a hard question to answer, because one of the goals of the study is to figure out what the risks are of pee to human beings. So this can be an extremely difficult question to answer in some cases. So the great example people give is first-in-human studies. So first time you give a drug to humans, you want to say, well, this is okay if the risks aren't excessive, but you might have very little idea of what the risks are because it hasn't yet been given to humans. And I think this is just one of the dilemmas that IRBs and others face in evaluating particularly early phase clinical research. We can talk about ways, I think, to finesse it if people are interested, but at least I want to make clear what the dilemma here is. Some other challenges, this you've probably talked about before. I talked a little bit about this in my talk on subject selection, which is that you have this tension between some of these different goals. So in this case, minimizing the risks of the study, which is one of the important aspects of risk-benefit analysis, can come into conflict with ensuring and promoting the social value of the study. So obviously, one of the ways to minimize the risk of the study is just to say, okay, you can give the subjects pee once a day, but you can't do these research blood draws. Those aren't in their interest, so you can't do any of these research blood draws. Well, that would reduce dramatically the risks of the study, but it would also undermine the value of the study. The point of the study is to try to look at the pharmacokinetic properties of pee, and you can't do that if you're not, at least as far as technology is today, you can't do that without withdrawing blood from them. So you have this tension between these different goals that you need to negotiate. How important is what you get from this intervention? How risky it is? Can you get that information other ways are some of the questions to ask here. And then another one is that you have this other problem, which is similar to the previous one, which is that, at least in a lot of cases, how risky an intervention is doesn't depend just on the intervention, but it also depends upon who undergoes that intervention. So one of the classic examples here I have is claustrophobia, where an MRI scan, at least the IRB I sit on, regards an MRI scan as minimal risk if it's done in the right setting. It's people who don't have problems with their hearing, people who aren't claustrophobic, people who don't have metal in their body. So if you get the right set of subjects, it can be minimal risk. But part of the problem is that IRBs don't know prospectively who it is that's going to enroll in the study. So obviously one of the ways you try to finesse this to a certain extent is with your inclusion-exclusion criteria. So you might say we're going to exclude people who have a history of claustrophobia, people who have a history of panic disorder, people who have certain kinds of metal in their bodies. So one of the real challenges, I think, of evaluating the risks and benefits of clinical research, and I'll give some examples of this in a minute, is that in simple cases, it's pretty clear to figure out whether or not something is a risk or a benefit, whether or not something is a harm or a benefit. So getting nauseous for a week seems clearly to be a harm to people. But Once you think about other cases, you realize this actually becomes a fairly complicated analysis. And what you find out is that even in the standard cases, what you're doing is to figure out whether something's a harm or a benefit, you compare it, at least implicitly, to some baseline. So why do you think being nauseous for a week is a harm? Well, because we assume that if the person didn't get the drug, that they wouldn't have nausea for that week. So what we're saying is being nauseous for a week is a harm compared to the implicit baseline of having, I don't know what the phrase is, okay stomach or something like that. So here's one of my slightly flip examples. I was thinking about a study I was talking to people when I was writing this about, a study in Mexico City. And one of the questions we had was, does breathing the air, going to that clinic and breathing the air that's going to be in that clinic, does that count as a risk of being in the study? And I take it the only way I can think to answer that question is you have to ask, well, what's the proper contrast against which you evaluate breathing the air in the clinic? So what's the baseline? So typically the comparison is to what we expect people are going to experience absent the research. So that was the nausea example. Nausea is a harm because we assume that if you're not in the study, you're just going to eat your normal diet and that your normal diet doesn't have that impact on your stomach. So typically, in most cases, breathing the research air doesn't count as a risk because we assume that if people weren't in the study, they'd be breathing roughly equivalent air anyway. So some of the comparisons I have here, there's an interesting study that we've talked about in our courses before of a proposal to look at the impact of breathing different levels of oxygen in air on infants. And so one of the proposals was, first they thought, well, okay, we want to see the impact of infants going on extended plane trips. So maybe we take a couple infants and put them on a plane, fly them around the world, and see what impact that has on them. And then other people said, well, that's kind of impractical. Why don't we instead put them in an ICU, put them on ventilators, and we can control what level of oxygen they're getting. Well, presumably in that study, you might think actually breathing the air that's present in that study is a risk because it's compared to breathing more oxygen risk air outside of the study. So I'll give you one other example, and then I think this brings up a real example, which I mentioned briefly last time, is to get a handle on this. So what I'm assuming is, imagine it's true, so people know that bullying behavior is, it turns out psychologically, an incredible problem for young kids. And it also turns out that a lot of young kids get bullied and get taunted essentially every day. Now, I don't know if there's data, I have no idea how often this happens, so I'm just making this up, but imagine that it happens roughly 5 times a day that the average kid gets bullied. Now, it's important to find out the impact of bullying, ways we can protect kids from bullying, the ways we can treat kids who get bullied. So there's at least some reason to want to do this in a clinical research study. So imagine what I propose is I'm going to take a bunch of average kids, I'm going to bring them into the clinic, and I'm going to taunt them 3 times a day. Now, is that a risky study or is that a beneficial study? So on the one hand, I think the natural inclination is to say, you can't do that. That's really risky. Taunting kids 3 times a day is a very bad thing, and it has the chance of harm. In fact, that's why you're doing your research in the first place, because you know it's bad for kids. So that's risky. But then you might say, well, wait, if they're not in your study, the prediction is that they're probably going to be taunted 5 times. So in your study, they get taunted only 3 times, that's 2 times less, so maybe there's some way in which this is a beneficial study. So I think these kinds of examples are really useful for thinking about how we work this comparison. There's a real study that's similar to this that I think I mentioned in the subject of ability to tell me. But so there's this study that was done at Hopkins and the Kennedy Krieger Institute in Baltimore where they took children who lived or were thought to live in houses that had a lot of lead paint in them. And we know that lead paint is very bad, at least for very young children. So what they wanted to see is they wanted to say, well, what happens if we take those kids out of those homes and we put them into houses that just have a little bit of lead paint in them? Is there some threshold effect so that we can completely protect them without having the cost of abating the house completely? So the study, in simplistic form, was taking kids who are in houses that have lots of lead paint and moving them into a research house that has a little bit of lead paint. And there's a debate now in the literature of whether or not that was a risky study. And in fact, there's one person, Lainey Ross, who was here, I guess, last week, who argues in a paper that that could be construed as a potential benefit study. And a lot of people say, look, we know lead paint is bad. Putting kids in a house with even any lead paint is risky, so it's a risky study. Her response was, no, if the assumption is that outside of this study, kids are going to be in a house that has complete lead paint, then it looks like there's a way in which you could argue this is a potentially beneficial study for them. It's decreasing their exposure to something that we know that is bad for their neurological development. So in some real cases, getting clear on what the appropriate comparison is can be very important for understanding risk. So that's just the lesson that I wanted to get out of that. So once we've identified all the risks, then we obviously want to minimize them. If you don't need a blood draw every day for your PK study, if you can do a blood draw every other day, that's better. If you only need one biopsy rather than two biopsies, that's better. If you don't need a biopsy at all, you can rely on some clinical biopsy they got last week, that's even better. So you want to try to minimize the risks as much as you can, and this often just requires clever clinicians. I find nurses on your study who can figure out ways to do things that are less risky. Okay, so then we want to talk about the benefits once we've figured out what the risks are and we've minimized them. So now we've got the risks over here. We know all the risks. We've minimized them as much as we can. Now in order to compare the risks and the benefits, we've got to figure out what the benefits are. So we determine the potential benefits of each of the research interventions. Presumably there's no benefits at all from the blood draws that the people are going to go through, but there's at least some potential benefit, I take it. We don't know how great, of getting oral P once a day for 21 days. Maybe not in the low dose groups, but maybe possibly in the higher dose groups. Okay. And again, the point here is, as with the risks, we want to consider only benefits of being in the research, not benefits of clinically indicated procedures, interventions, drugs that they would get, even if they're not in your study. So what counts as a benefit? And here there's an interesting disanalogy that I just want to call people's attention to between risks and benefits, where most people say in the literature, if you look through the literature, most people will say that paying subjects to be in a research study doesn't count as a direct benefit to them. And in a way, you might say that's surprising, right? Most of us at least think getting money is a good thing. Getting more money is even better than getting less money. So that getting paid for a study would be good. Getting paid a lot for a study would be really good. But in fact, a lot of people in the research ethics literature say that, at least from the perspective of the IRB shouldn't regard payment as a benefit for people who get into the study. And so one of the questions here is, what's the reason for this and what should we think about it? And here's my keep giving you scary thoughts from my own personal clinic that I run down the hall here if you ever want to come visit. So what if I propose a study in which I'll subjects would pay $100 to undergo a biopsy, and then if they're hurt from my biopsy, there's bleeding, they have to go to the doctor, they miss out on work for a couple days, I'm not going to do anything about that, which is unfortunately in some cases at least the way we have things today in this country. So I'll give you $100, but you've got to pay for any research injuries. Well, what most people will say, and I'm going to largely leave this as a question, whether or not people think this is right, if there's any justification for this. What most people in research ethics will say is that there's serious financial risks to those subjects. If there's a chance that they're going to be harmed and they're going to have to pay for those injuries, that's a financial risk that you have to take into account in the risk-benefit analysis. But the fact that you're going to pay them for the biopsy, that doesn't count as a benefit that can be used to offset the financial risks. So even though one's a financial benefit, one's a financial risk, you don't get to count the financial benefit of paying them. I think it's an interesting question of whether or not that approach makes sense. I'm not sure it makes sense, but I'm not sure it doesn't. But anyway, this was my brainstorming. Here are some thoughts on possible reasons why it might make sense. So some of them, traditional ones people talk about. So the second one is people have this worry, probably needs to be further explained, that paying people in research somehow commodifies research. It somehow is inappropriate to the very nature of research, or that it somehow changes the nature of the research encounter. So initially you've got somebody who's coming to help for maybe altruistic reasons or because they want to get health benefit, and now you're turning it into a financial transaction. And somehow that seems problematic to some people. So we could talk about these if people are interested. But I think this is a very much an open question about whether or not this disanalogous way of treating financial risks and benefits makes sense. So when we found the risks, we want to minimize them. And now when we find the benefits, we want to enhance them to the extent that we can that's feasible. So if there's a way of delivering the drug that offers the chance for more benefit, As long as it doesn't undermine the science, we should do that. If we find things out from the blood draws that are clinically significant that may help people, we should tell them that. So we find ways to try to help people as much as we can as part of the study. Okay, so now we've got figured out the risks, we've minimized them, we've figured out the benefits, we've tried to make them as big as we can, and then we get to the hard part of trying to compare our two groups here, compare the risks to the benefits. And there's different ways to conceptualize this. I'll just start with a fairly standard one, which is what people ask the question is, do the potential benefits to the subjects of being in the study justify, in some sense, the risks that they'll face from being in the study? And that raises the further question, one of the real ethical dilemmas here, is what happens when the answer to that question is no? What happens when we have a study for which the risks clearly exceed the benefits? Maybe there's no benefits and there's some risks, or there's no benefits and there's a lot of risks, which is an example we'll think about in a minute. Is that kind of research ever ethically acceptable? When can it be ethically acceptable? Here's a little bit of a side tangent into some of the murky depths of the literature for people who are interested. So you can, if you're not interested in the murky depths, you can zone. You get to zone out for the next 3 minutes. There's this prominent strand of argument in the research ethics literature, which basically says the answer to that previous question, whether or not it's okay to expose research subjects to what I call net risks, to interventions or studies where the risks exceed the benefits. Some people argue that that depends on the nature of the intervention in question. Roughly, it depends upon what people have historically called therapeutic versus non-therapeutic interventions. And it's not exactly clear what this definition is, but roughly the idea is a therapeutic intervention is one where you think it's going to help, or you're trying to help, or the study is designed to try to help people. And the argument that some people make is, in that setting, when you're using a therapeutic intervention, then net risks are impermissible. Net risks are unacceptable. In effect, the idea is, when you're using therapeutic interventions, you've got what you might think of as a physician-patient relationship, and within the context of that relationship, you have to treat the patient as a patient, and therefore you can't expose them to risks for the benefit of others. That would roughly constitute malpractice. Even though we're in the research setting, given that it's a therapeutic intervention, it should be evaluated as if it were a clinical one. And one of the important things that comes out of this, which you'll see in a lot of the literature if you go through it, one of the implications of this view is what people call clinical equipoise becomes an ethical requirement for therapeutic research. So the idea is if you've got a therapeutic intervention, then you can only use it when the evidence suggests it's as good as anything else you could do. If it's even slightly less good than other things you could do, when it's a therapeutic intervention, it's unethical. So this is where one of the places where people make the argument for clinical equipoise. All right, so the detour is over. This is the end of the detour. I actually think this is a mistaken view. I think there are a couple problems with it which we could discuss more. One is, as I kind of wave my hand at how you define the distinction, I don't think it's even clear what the distinction is in the first place between therapeutic and non-therapeutic interventions. And if you look through the literature, different people define it in different and, I think, often unclear ways. The second issue is that even if you could come up with a clear definition, I don't see any ethical reason why it's more problematic to expose subjects to risks in the context of a therapeutic study than it is in the context of a non-therapeutic study. So one of the ways I described this in a paper that was in your reading for people who saw it is one of the places this comes up a lot, this distinction, is in pediatric research. And my argument was, I can imagine parents who are worried about exposing their kids to research risks for the benefit of others. I completely understand that. But I can't imagine a parent who thinks, okay, it's okay for you to expose my kid to risks for the benefit of others, but only in the context of a non-therapeutic study. If it's a therapeutic study, I don't want there to be any added risks to my kid. I don't see why, from a parent's point of view, the context matters. What they care is the risks that their kid faces and the potential benefits. So I don't see what moral work this distinction is doing, even if you can make it clear. So what's the alternative? The alternative I've been trying to argue for is what I call the net risks test, which has generally 3 steps, roughly. Does the research intervention, so we're looking first at individual interventions, remember, does the intervention pose net risks? If so, how great are the net risks? And then how great are the cumulative net risks? So we haven't talked about this yet, but you want to look at the net risks of the individual interventions. But then at the end, to evaluate the whole study, you got to put them all together. So a study that has 10 million minimal risk interventions may end up being a very risky study if you add it all together. So you can't just look at the risks of the interventions. So how do you figure out whether or not an intervention poses net risks? So the way that I described this before was you ask the question of whether the potential benefits of undergoing the intervention justify the risks to subjects. And if so, then you have to do a second thing. What you want to do is you want to compare that intervention's risk-benefit profile to the risk-benefit profile of alternative interventions that people could get otherwise. So the idea is if you have a drug and it has some chance to benefit people, that might not count as a potential benefit study if it turns out that in clinical care, instead of your drug, they'd get something that's clearly better. Right? So you need to not only know the, in a sense, internal risk-benefit profile, but you need to know how that risk-benefit profile compares to what people would get otherwise. So there's two steps to the first step, in effect. There's a lot of interesting, for people who are interested in this, literature, particularly in philosophy, on how is it that you compare risks and benefits? How can we say whether or not a 1% chance of tumor shrinkage is justifying or doesn't justify an 85% chance that I'll feel nauseous for a week, my hair will change color, and I'll have a 30-point increase in my blood pressure? How is it that you can even make those comparisons? Some people argue, some philosophers argue, that it's actually impossible to do it. There's no way to make these comparisons. My view is what we should do is not worry about how we do it, but just rely on the fact that in practice we actually do it. And the way I try to take advantage of this fact is by what I call the informed clinician test. So the idea is you just ask a clinician, do you think, caring only about this person's medical interests, it would be a good idea for the person to be undergo this intervention or be in the study? And if the answer is yes, then the idea is that that's a potentially beneficial study, or, in other words, the potential benefits justify the risks. If the answer is no, then the potential benefits don't justify the risks, or, in other words, the risks exceed the potential benefits. You need a default here, and basically my default is that if the clinician would be indifferent, says, it doesn't matter one way or another, then that's an acceptable study. So the only worrisome studies are, as the name of the test suggests, studies that pose net risks, so studies where the risks exceed the potential benefits to the subjects. Those are the ones that are particularly ethically worrisome. And then also there's this question, as I just mentioned, about the net risks. You want to look at the net risks of the individual interventions, and you also want to look at the cumulative net risks of all of the net risk interventions that are included in the study and see whether or not they're acceptable. Now, this leads to one of the great challenges in this area, which is, how do we figure out when net risks are acceptable? Or, if you remember one of my first slides, the question was making sure risks to subjects aren't excessive. How do we know when net risks exceed that threshold and become ethically inappropriate because they're excessive? So roughly the idea is if the net risks and the net cumulative risks are really low, and this is typically what most IRBs allowed, and the study has important social value, then the assumption is that's an acceptable study, as long as you have other things in place that you've already talked about, fair subject selection, informed consent, independent review, and all of those things. But at least with respect to risks and benefits, it's the assumption is that those risks and benefits are acceptable. Low risks, important study, that's an acceptable risk-benefit profile. Leaves us with a question about what do we think when the net risks of an intervention are especially high. And there's two situations in which that might happen. And this brings us to, one other complication, which is called the package deal. Bob Levine, who's one of the giants in this field, described what he called the fallacy of the package deal. His argument was that you should evaluate the risks and benefits of research interventions individually, such that the risks of a particular research intervention can only be justified by the potential benefits of that intervention. So that if you have any interventions which pose really high risks and no potential benefits, then those interventions are unacceptable on this view, independent of what else is true about the study. So I think this is a very interesting question. And the question, here's a way to think about it in concrete terms, basically, is imagine we have a study for some sort of CNS tumor or some sort of liver tumor where we want to give the people the drug, But we also have to do a research biopsy. So we have to do a brain biopsy, or we have to do a risky liver biopsy. The biopsy offers no chance of benefit, has serious risks. And the question is, can it be acceptable to have people with cancer, bad cancer typically, undergo such a non-beneficial research biopsy in the context of a study that has a drug that offers them significant potential for benefit? Now, if you agree with Bob Levine that this so-called package deal is a fallacy, you'll say, no, the risks of the biopsy have to be justified by any potential benefits of the biopsy. And if so, if they're high risk and no benefits, it's unacceptable, even though there's this drug that they'll also get access to. And so that's, I think, a really interesting question. 4 years ago, Zeke, who you've talked to, and Don Rosenstein, who you'll meet later this morning, and I were going on a hike in Machu Picchu in Peru, and we spent about an hour of the hike coming up with examples to press this and debating whether or not the fallacy of the package deal is a fallacy. I think by the end, I don't think it's a fallacy. I think sometimes it is, but sometimes it's not. I think by the end I had convinced Don, we'll see. I don't think I had convinced Zeke by the end of it, though. But Machu Picchu is a very nice place to have philosophical debates if you get the opportunity. Okay. So the second possibility is where you have high risk of intervention and they're not justified by any other benefits within the context of that study. Rather, you've got high risks to these people and there's potential benefits through the social value of the study and the information you're collecting to others. And so this, I take it, is the crucial question in risk-benefit analysis in clinical research, whether or not that can be acceptable. So we could talk about this if people have questions about it. I'll just give you a simple example. Imagine that we could come up with a study that we thought had a real chance of making serious progress on some devastating disease, like AIDS or Alzheimer's disease. But that study posed a serious risk to the subject, something like maybe a 1 in 500 or 1 in 1,000 risk of death to people in the study, but it's the only way to get information that could be really important for saving the lives, thousands, maybe tens of thousands, maybe millions of people. The question is, could that kind of study ever be acceptable, or is that a clear case of just exploiting these people for the benefit of other people, and is that just a paradigm example of unethical research? So that's a question I'll leave if people want to talk about at the end. So in terms of the question here on the table is, when are net risks acceptable? People typically divide the question into whether or not you're enrolling vulnerable subjects, like adults who can't consent, children, or you're enrolling people who aren't vulnerable. And for at least some vulnerable subjects, there's strict limits on the risks. Typically, it has to be what people call minimal risk, or the U.S. regulations, at least with respect to children, allows a minor increase over minimal risk. And basically, minimal risk, not everybody agrees with this, but a lot of regulations around the world have adopted what's roughly a U.S. definition, which is that to determine whether the net risks are minimal or not, you compare them to the risks that that population faces in daily life or that average normal people face in daily life. And if the risks of your research are no greater than the risks that average normal people face in daily life, then the risks are defined as minimal, and it suggests that the study is acceptable. If the risks are greater than the risks that average normal people face in daily life, they're greater than minimal, and then depending upon your population, either you can't do it, so if it's some studies with children, or you have to have extra special safeguards. So this leaves the question of, how about non-vulnerable subjects? Is there some threshold for doing this sort of research in rational, reasonable, informed, intelligent people? So if I could get 10 people who are willing to come to my clinic and be enrolled in this study with a 1 in 1,000 risk of death, would it then be acceptable, or is it still unacceptable, even though they understand, they're willing to consent, and all of those conditions are satisfied? Okay, so I'm going to end here. Basically, what I want to do, so this is just bringing us back to the framework and applying it. What I wanted to do is just go through and apply it to the study of P. And what's underlined here are some of the challenges that I mentioned at each of the steps. But maybe instead of just doing that, unless people want me to do that, maybe I'll just leave that slide up. Some people can go through in their head. So this will be your in-house homework assignment of seeing how you apply each of these steps to P. And then anybody else who doesn't want to do that can ask me easy questions that make me look really good. Okay. But as a reminder, this is being webcast, so that if you do have a question, please come to the mic so that it gets picked up and can get heard by people at distant locations. Okay.
Do burdens count as risks? The burden of treatment, having to come back for multiple x-rays, to come back into the clinic, do they count as risks, and how does one scale in the burdens into this calculation?
Right. So do burdens count as risks? I'll give you two reasons. When I first came to the NIH, saw these patients who looked like they were in serious distress and maybe pain, and I was talking to a couple people about it, and I said, do you think we could do anything about this? And they're like, those aren't harms. Dave, you're confused. You know, those aren't harms. Harms are things like your kidney stops working. Not feeling a little crummy or being in pain, that's not a harm, that's a burden. Another example I'm giving, there's the Endocrine Society is having a national meeting to talk about risks and benefits of pediatric research in 2 weeks. And their focus is a study that was done in normal kids. They were trying to develop, they didn't have any baseline values for normal hormone levels in children. And so what they wanted to do is they wanted to bring in a group of healthy children, put them into the lab, have them sleep overnight, and get hormone levels across the night. And the IRB argued they couldn't do that because bringing children into a study is excessively burdensome. It exceeds the minimal risk level with respect to burns, therefore it was an unacceptable study. So you got some investigators who are like, pain's not even a burden, doesn't even count as a harm. Other people who, you can't even put people in the study. What do other people think? Are burns harms? Should they be treated in some different way? Anybody have thought? I mean, my simple answer, maybe this is too simplistic, is, as I said before, I think of interests as in a very broad way. Interests are basically, things that are in your interest are things that make your life go better, to some extent or another. Harms are things that detract from, set back the extent to which your life goes well. And so I don't think of harms and burdens as in any qualitative way. I mean, quantitatively they can be very different, but qualitatively I don't think of them as any different at all. I mean, being bored or having to sit around in a clinic for 3 hours, that's not as bad as being in serious pain. But I think it sets back my interests a little bit. Presumably I could be doing something else more fun or more interesting. So I think they are harms. I mean, they're mini harms, largely, but they are harms, and they should be counted as much.
Just about your last, coming back to your last point about excessive risk, I'd like to draw the attention of people to the issue of the studies in bone marrow transplant for adjuvant breast cancer, which had a risk of mortality, and in fact many patients died in those studies.
Yeah.
But the data from those studies ultimately prevented and stopped multiple patients having this treatment off study, which probably led to the deaths of hundreds of women.
Yeah. So, good. So there's this fascinating question, which we're not going to talk about today, but brings up this question of, typically we think about doing research on interventions that you think are possibly going to be useful or effective. But what if you're in a situation where you have a lot of clinicians in the community who are using an intervention that you're convinced is a really bad idea, but you can't get them to stop? But you could get them to stop if you did a research study of the intervention and showed scientifically that it was a bad idea. Is that social value, showing that something's really bad? Can you enroll people in such a study where the hypothesis is that this intervention is terrible and we're going to give it to you to make you really sick or maybe kill some people in order to convince other people that it's bad? That's a great question. But
So I was going back to the harms versus burdens thing. I think with burdens, it's going to be a lot easier to argue that it can be offset with benefits. That is, with burdens, it's a lot easier to say you can pay people to mitigate that. Yeah. Like the inconvenience of coming in, you know, being bored. It seems like there's no problem to, you know, pay people not to be bored, pay people to the inconvenience of, you know, travel, et cetera. So, yeah.
Good. So you're not as worried about payment offsetting burdens as you are about the possibility of benefits offsetting risks of physical harm.
Right.
Yeah. Good. We'll have to think about it. Part of my problem is I have such a hard time getting my head around the worries about financial payments that it's hard for me to know what I think. Although Christine and I are doing a study right now where we're interviewing teens and we offer them a $20 gift certificate, and I can assure you they regard it as a very serious and nice compensation for the pain of having to sit there and talk to us for half an hour.
They do. Dave, I wondered if you could say a little bit more about the cumulative risk issue, because
yeah.
I think one of the things I've wondered about, so if your study requires a blood draw, and that's a minimal risk kind of procedure, And but then there's 20 blood draws within 24 hours. Maybe you could see that it raises the risk a little bit.
Right.
But what if the blood draws are every 6 months or every year?
Right.
Is that the same kind of cumulative risk, or is that different because of this the sort of spread of time?
Yeah. Well, I think it's a great question. Basically, with respect to cumulative risk, we wrote a paper where we tried to quantify, to take seriously the minimal risk standard, and we tried to quantify the risks that normal, average, healthy people face from individual interventions or activities like riding a bicycle, going to school, taking a ride in the car. And then we also tried to calculate the cumulative risks of daily life by trying to describe what we thought was a normal, average, daily life. We were thinking about kids. So we thought, okay, they probably take maybe 2 car trips. Maybe they go play on the playground for an hour. They go to school, and they have a bath or something like that. And we figured out the risks of all those activities. And we thought, okay, those are going to be the cumulative risks for a study that lasts for a day. So that if your study lasts for roughly a day, you know, if it's a 6-hour study, and the cumulative risks are below the cumulative risks of that described average day, then in our view, it's a minimal risk study. But it does raise this question, which so my sense is that would be an okay study if those risks are below those daily risks for a day. But imagine they're just slightly below that level, and imagine the study lasts for a month, a week, a month, a year, 5 years. At each point, the risks of the study are below the risks of daily life. So it seems if you add it up, you can't get above the risks of daily life because for each segment, you're below it. But for some reason, that does make me nervous after a while. So I don't know if I have a good explanation for why. I don't know if it makes other people nervous. But I would say that at some point, even cumulative days of minimal risk ends up being more than minimal risk, or at least ends up being unacceptable for some other reason. I mean, maybe it's just, I wonder if maybe it's some distributional worry where it's still minimal risk for that kid, but if it's 10 years, you start thinking, you know, geez, maybe somebody else should be doing some of this instead of this kid. Yes?
That's exactly my question is, what's the difference between social value and the value for the individual, and how does that interplay into research? Because you can have benefits to the individual, but not the society in large. So how do you define individual and
right?
Yeah, and social.
So the way tell me this answer question. The way I think about it, just roughly, is that so the individual benefits are just things that could happen, or in terms of benefits, rather potential benefits, things that do happen to the individual as a result of being in the study that are good for them. So in the study of P, a benefit would be that your tumor shrinks, say, or that your tumor stops growing. That would be a benefit to the individuals. And then the social value is basically how valuable is the information that you get out of the study for the purposes of improving healthcare in the future for other subjects. And sometimes the benefits that happen to individuals are part of that information. So in this study, if they knew of this drug, so take 2 different people. In this study, they were bringing people who have all sorts of tumors. Well, they already knew that this drug has an impact on renal cell cancer. So I think if they brought in somebody who had renal cell cancer and it shrunk their tumor, for the investigators, that wouldn't be a particularly interesting finding and probably wouldn't be a socially valuable finding. They'd say, look, we already knew that it worked in that setting, but clearly that would be a benefit for that individual to have their tumor shrink. On the other hand, if they brought somebody else who had some other sort of tumor, somebody who had a lung tumor or a brain tumor or anything else, if they brought that person in and that tumor stopped growing or that tumor shrunk, that would be a benefit to them, but that also would be social value, right? Because now we've learned something important for other people. Not only does this drug have an effect on renal cell, but it also has an effect on lung cancer or something else. Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Our next discussion is going to be on clinical research with pregnant women. And this is a new topic for us. We haven't had this in the course until this year. Which makes me remember to remind you about another aspect of what I would like from you, and that is your evaluations. We take your evaluations very seriously, and so when you recommend new topics or recommend new speakers or recommend, well, sometimes we can even try to change the temperature in the room, but things that you write on the evaluations, we do take seriously and try to think about how to make the course as good as it can be each time. So this year we're introducing this topic, clinical research with pregnant women, and we have with us to address this topic a dear friend of our department, Maggie Little, who is an associate professor of philosophy at Georgetown University, also a senior research scholar at the Kennedy Institute of Ethics at Georgetown University, and proudly a member of an NIH entity called Obstetrical Field Pharmacology Research Unit at the NIH. And so Maggie's going to talk to us about clinical research with pregnant women.
Where does this turn on? It's on. When that light's on, it's on.
There goes. And there's no. Can you all hear me? And there's no interference? Yeah? Okay, can you bring the lights up, or is that not possible? We'll see. Well, since I'm going to talk with you all this morning about research on pregnant women, I have to bring up the first issue of Sexism, which is that women's suits don't have pockets, so I get to hold this the whole time. Heavens. Well, thank you so much for coming this morning, and thank you. Thank you for coming this morning and taking a look at this set of difficult issues around how to do ethical research on human subjects. I've just returned to my home institution of Georgetown University after spending a year here at the Department of Bioethics here at the NIH with Chris and the other people you're getting a chance to talk with this morning. The topic that I came to work on is one that's very dear to my heart, and it is about the responsible inclusion of pregnant women in clinical research. And I'd like to tell you a bit about what we don't know about how to treat pregnant women, why we need to figure out how to treat pregnant women, and why that means we have to face the elephant in the room about doing research with pregnant women, and actually ask for your help, because this is part of an ongoing effort to make progress on the difficult issue, see how we can tweak the regs, and we're holding a big conference in spring at the campus of Georgetown, where Chris and other NIH and FDA people will come along, called The Second Wave, moving from just women being included in clinical research trials to pregnant women. And so any ideas and advice you have, I'll take to that conference. You can be part of the next generation of progress here. All right. It's by now widely known that, especially here at the NIH, that in the 1990s reports came out showing that women in general were radically underrepresented in clinical research trials. The examples are now infamous. One of the most significant studies on aging, a 30-year longitudinal study, started in the early 1970s, no women, even though women make up two-thirds of the aged population. Early cardiovascular studies, some of the best, the aspirin a day keeps the heart attack away. That initial finding, no women included in the trial, even though heart disease is, of course, the number one killer of women in America. There was even an early breast cancer trial. No women, go figure. Okay. So the reports came out. People went, this is kooky, what's happening? A lot of study was done on it. The Institute of Medicine came out with a wonderful report. The NIH Revitalization Act of 93 said, look, you need to justify on the basis other than cost, excluding any specific subpopulation in research, because if they're going to end up using the drugs, we need to know how the drug works in that kind of body. So while so much progress has been made, some, of course, needs to still be done, but I can now report that women make up a majority of research participants in the United States in clinical research. But while we've made a great deal of progress getting women in general into clinical research trials, there is one group of women that we have not addressed and in fact turned a blind eye to, and that is the pregnant woman. The reason for this, of course, is obvious. Well-intentioned worry about the status of the fetus. If she's in a clinical research trial, so is the fetus. And for pregnancies that are going to be continued, whatever your view of fetal status doesn't matter, because there's going to be a person at the end of the pregnancy whose health is affected by what happened in utero. So everybody can agree that fetal protections are enormously important when it comes to pregnant women being in research trials. Nobody disagrees. But while nobody disagrees with that, we have, in fact, taken the easy way out when it comes to pregnant women in research, which is we just summarily exclude them. In contrast to the Institute of Medicine's report, which explicitly, after studying this at length, argued that even with pregnant women, we shouldn't presume exclusion. We should, in fact, instead take careful, deliberative look at a given trial and see whether she can be ethically or should be included or not. But it should be a decision with respect to every clinical trial. Sometimes the answer will be easy. We don't need to include pregnant women in studying prostate cancer. We don't need to include them in non-medically important pharmacology trials of some wrinkle cream. But it's a question that needs to be raised, just as we raise it of every other subpopulation, and justified if not. Why is this so? Why do we need to face this and make decisions about their inclusion rather than just simply exclude them? Well, what I want to do is rehearse for you four reasons why we have to. The first one is that we need to know, I hope, by the way, that every one of the four is obvious to this audience. But I'm going to state them explicitly because, despite how obvious they seem to be, again, clinical researchers and IRBs tend to just exclude pregnant women unthinkingly. First, we need to know how to effectively treat pregnant women when they fall ill. Despite romantic illusions to the contrary, pregnancy is not a prophylaxis against illness. Pregnant women continue to have chronic diseases or have diseases that emerge during pregnancy. Pregnant women have cardiovascular disease, hypertension, high cholesterol, diabetes, cancer, asthma, severe recalcitrant depressions. 40% of pregnant women have their pregnancies complicated by some illness. Ask any obstetrician, and he or she will tell you they need to make decisions every day in the clinic about what to do with the illness. But they don't have information on how to treat pregnant women. Why can't we just borrow the knowledge, that is, take the knowledge studied on a non-pregnant female body or even a male body? Well, it turns out, and again, this should be no surprise when you think about it, that the physiology of pregnancy acts as a wild card with pharmacokinetics and dynamics. The pregnant body acts differently. To give just one example, the massive increase in blood flow and what happens through the kidneys means that a lot of drugs get metabolized out very, very quickly. I'll give you one startling and worrisome example. Chris mentioned that I'm a member of the OPRU, multi-site group, three-years effort, funded by the NIH, looking at this issue. One of the sites in Seattle did what are called opportunistic studies of pregnant women. These are the great ethical low-hanging fruit of clinical research trials because we take pregnant women who are already ill and under doctor's orders to take some medication. And then you do blood draws to see what the pharmacokinetics and dynamics look like. So you do a blood draw, but that's the only imposed risk, okay? Of four women who sadly were struggling with virulent leukemias, they needed to be on chemotherapy or they would die. And hello, if they die, who else dies? The fetus, okay? So they were on a chemotherapeutic regime, do the blood draw. It turns out that the pregnant body so thoroughly metabolized out the chemo, it's as though she was getting no medication at all. Even as they found that the toxicities of the chemotherapeutic regime crossed the placental border. So you're poisoning the fetus, not helping the mother. You're going to have dead women, dead babies. It's not fun to think of including pregnant women in research trials. But if you don't, you harm women and fetuses alike. Right now, of all the medications that are out there, only, I can't use fingers because I'm holding this, 12 medications are approved by the FDA for use in pregnant women. All of them are drugs about how to get the baby out or not out, that is to help deal with pregnancy-related issues like nausea or to delay or promote labor. Anything used to treat non-obstetrical related illness is not approved. Pregnancy, it turns out, is an off-label condition. That means that, but it doesn't mean that pregnant women aren't using drugs. It means they're using drugs without data. And we at the NIH here know that that's not a good idea. So we're doing basically post-marketing experimentation on pregnant women and their fetuses. It's sort of like the lesson that pediatrics research learned. If we could borrow knowledge, if we could, for instance, not study any humans and just do animals, yay, but we can't. If we could just study grown-ups, then we wouldn't have to deal with the ethical complexities of studying children. But it turns out, as they said so beautifully, children are not just short adults. Well, pregnant women are not just fat women. Okay? The mantra we know, if you're going to use a drug in a population, you need to study the drug in the population. And that brings me to reason number two, why we need to include pregnant women in clinical research. Fetal safety. That is the very reason that pregnant women are sort of summarily excluded. If we don't study drugs that pregnant women will use, we may be imposing bad, needless risk to the fetus. The thalidomide disaster has cast an enormously long shadow over research ethics with pregnancy. And it's a shadow, of course, that deserves to be taken extremely seriously. Nobody is advocating unfettered inclusion of pregnant women in clinical research trials. But the thalidomide disaster is actually instructive in the other direction. For that disaster happened not because women were included in the research trial of thalidomide, but because they were excluded. We didn't do early studies of small doses to see what might be happening. Instead, we took a drug and just did, as I mentioned before, a kind of post-marketing experimentation on women and their fetuses. When a disaster struck, which it did there, we then went the other direction and said, we'll never touch women in research. But women continue to use medication. This might surprise you. The average pregnant woman is on 1.2 prescriptions during her pregnancy. Two-thirds of pregnant women use 4 to 5 medications. That's not even counting over-the-counter. So pregnant women are going to be using the medications. If they're going to use the medications, we would like to know what an efficacious and safe version of the medicine would be. So that when we make those hard decisions about somebody who's got cancer or uncontrolled hypertension or diabetes, we can make reasoned decisions as opposed to unreasoned decisions. Here's a further reason that we need to include pregnant women in clinical research. It's a kind of indirect harm that happens. For pregnancies that are going to be continued, pregnant women tend to care about their fetus more than just about anything. In a culture that tells them, and partly because of that long shadow of the thalidomide disaster, that taking a drop of anything is like poison, right? Now you're not even supposed to drink coffee. I'll get back to that example in a second. And forget wine. Okay, I could deal with the wine, but not coffee? Now you're asking too much. Okay, that sort of a drop of anything is seen as an infecting poison. Then the idea of putting somebody in a trial where we intentionally introduce some drug can seem anathema. And a woman going to her clinician who has a difficult illness often feels enormous anxiety at the thought of taking a pill, even when he or she, the clinician, says, you need to do this. So let me tell you about my friend Brenda. Brenda's like the walking poster child to me. She's actually why I got interested in this issue, about why we need to deal with it and what's changed over the last 10 years and what hasn't. So Brenda's first child, born 12 years ago, my friend Brenda has had all of her life severe recalcitrant depression at the level where she's a suicide risk if she's not properly treated. Okay, poorly treated depression when it's severe, what's the annual mortality rate? 10 to 20% from suicide. Okay. When Brenda first got pregnant, her doctor, 12 years ago, her doctor says, well, you have to go off your SSRI. She went off cold turkey because she wanted to be a good mommy. I got to visit Brenda in the lockdown ward of the psych unit. Brenda had uncontrolled anorexia all through her pregnancy. And again, felt enormous guilt at the anorexia because she was trying to be a good mommy, but she was crazy. A little Prozac would have gone a long way. Fast forward 5 more years, she's pregnant again. By this time, we've got lots of data on Prozac, at least, you know, an old drug, that it looks like for those with severe depression, it's worth the trade-off. It's a fairly safe drug. And this time, fortunately, Brenda had a better obstetrician who was up on the data. And a friend who went to NIH and asked her friends, what's the data say? Okay. It's really safe. It's really clear. You know, a little bit of low birth weight versus mom who's incredibly depressed. What are the risks to her? And by the way, her born children, not good to have a severely depressed mom. Stay on your Prozac. And in fact, you may need to up it because remember that whole dosing thing we have to keep a close eye on. But despite the encouragement of her OB and her best friend, Brenda, and very understandably given our culture, didn't take the pill. I once again got to visit Brenda in the psych unit. These days, Brenda counsels other pregnant women on what it feels like to be that scared to take a pill. But here's the issue that she reminds them of. We have a tendency to notice the risks of intervening on the pregnant body without noticing the risks of not treating the pregnant body. Okay. The risk of taking a pill can be far less, as you all will understand, than leaving a significant illness not treated. Yet when I go and talk to people, to physicians, more specifically, about this issue, the number of stories I've collected, they're hard to hear. So one physician came up to me and he said, you know, you're absolutely right, and let me tell you about the story of my colleague who had a patient who had severe cancer, but they just stopped doing any treatment of the cancer because they're thinking, look at the, you know, we're putting poison in her body. And, of course, she died. And if the pregnant woman dies, the fetus usually does too. So one thing I do want to underscore is that talking about inclusion of pregnant women in clinical research trials is not about saying the woman deserves care even at terrible risk to the fetus. Far more often, not always, but far more often, their interests are more aligned than that. That what's good for fetuses is a healthy maternal body. So treat the pregnant woman in the first instance and then think about pregnancy later. Here's the fourth reason we need to talk about inclusion of pregnant women in clinical research trial. And this is an issue that has to do with both justice and benefits. It has to do only with a portion of clinical research trials, those that offer the prospect of direct benefit. So as you all know, many, many trials, despite what the enrollees often think, no matter how often you tell them otherwise, many clinical research trials offer no prospect of direct benefit to their participants. We're doing the early sorts of trials and just sort of finding out data. But, of course, later trials, the reason we're testing in a population is because we think we might have something that really works. We don't know, otherwise we couldn't do the trial. We just have to use it as treatment. But it might. And once you're dealing with a trial that carries the potential, not guaranteed, but potential direct benefit for the cohort that ends up in the active arm, then we have an issue of access to that potential benefit. In research ethics, we worry not just about protections, but about the justice of access. To summarily exclude pregnant women from all trials means that pregnant women do not have, pregnant women and their fetuses, remember, don't have access to the potential direct benefit of the trial. Let me give an example. One of my colleagues was sitting on the IRB at her institution, and one of the international microbicide trials came across their desk. So microbicide gels, as most of you know, at least at that point, were thought to carry some significant potential for radically, given the risk, given the low risks, decreasing the transmission, heterosexual transmission of HIV. Okay. The trial was ongoing and up for renewal, and one of the investigators came to the IRB meeting and said, we're having a terrible time with retention. All my women keep getting pregnant, so I have to boot them. And he asked, and why are you booting the pregnant women? Because they're pregnant. And he said, you know, the regulations allow inclusion of pregnant women. There, you can't have too high a risk to the fetus, but this one would clearly pass muster. It's a topical gel. Animal studies had indicated that it's not systemically absorbed. If there are minor risks to the fetus, they would be minor. And at any rate, what's the risk of booting to the fetus, forget the woman for a minute, of booting the woman from the trial? Well, look, if she's pregnant, isn't that an indication that she's having unprotected sex? I mean, am I wrong? And if she's having unprotected sex, doesn't that mean she's at risk for HIV? And wouldn't HIV be, like, really bad for her and maybe, like, even for the fetus? And to which the researcher said, well, I just don't include pregnant women. That's the kind of sort of cognitive framework that I think a lot of researchers take to clinical research when they think of pregnant women. Kind of like in the old days, well, because it's a female. I don't do females. I had one guy say, this was many years ago, I'm older than I look, many years ago this guy said, well, of course I don't study female rats, they're female. Okay, so just like we used to boot out all the women, now it's just like we boot out all the pregnancy because, well, isn't it kind of obvious? You know, they're complicated hormonally and biologically, and besides that whole fetus thing, and I don't like it. The ethical, I don't know. Right. Well, once again, I want to be clear. It's not that we should have pregnant women in all clinical research trials. But it's very problematic for researchers and members of an IRB to think you don't need to justify the decision of whether or not the pregnant woman is in the trial. The tendency to just boot pregnant women or not include them is actually, I think, a very natural one. So well-intentioned people end up doing this. Why? Well, my goodness. Not only are researchers really busy and have enough ethical complexities and regulations to deal with, but the regulations set up an incentive structure that virtually guarantees this kind of attitude. Because what they do is say, here's what you need to show in order to include pregnant women, as well they should, right? That there are no more than minimal risk to the fetus, that we know this about animals, that you can't borrow the knowledge elsewhere, etc. That pregnant women will be using this drug, would need to. Okay. But they don't balance that with a burden of justifying not including pregnant women. But we do that with virtually every other subpopulation. That is, you need to tell me why you're not studying a population that's going to be one of the primary users of this, like microbicide gel, okay? So that we balance the incentive that you have to confront the question, and that means have a conversation about whether pregnant women should be in the trial. And that conversation includes pausing and saying, asking two questions. I mean, before you even get into the details of regulations and stuff. What is the cost to these women here now and to their fetuses of not getting to be in the trial? Second, what is the cost to future pregnant women and their fetuses of not having knowledge specific to the pregnant body? If the answer to both of those is not much, then go on your merry way. You don't need to deal with pregnant women. But if the answer is it would actually be a problem, then we want to start asking questions. How big of a harm would it be to not include them? What does our background knowledge look like of the risk that you would be imposing to the fetus? Minimal? Unknown? Big? Should we be asking you then to go out and proactively look at the animal data or preliminary studies to see, do we have models of the maternal placental unit that tell us which, with some categories of drugs, which things cross the placental barrier and which don't, but to start putting that picture together if, again, you've answered one of those two questions in the affirmative, that there would be a likelihood of harm to pregnant women and fetuses not to be in this very trial, or again, to future pregnant women and their fetuses. Well, that's the argument about why we need to confront this issue. Now let me tell you some of the barriers to confronting to this issue so that you can help us out. One issue, as I mentioned, is a sort of cultural issue that we can have a tendency to think that we shouldn't, the idea of a pregnant woman ingesting something that's unknown is very frightening to many people. How many in here have ever read What to Expect When You're Expecting? Okay, I'm not for book burning except for that book. It's gotten a little better over the years, but I have a research assistant who just tracks each edition for me. Because this is a book that just, I do a lot of work in risk reasoning and risk communication, and it's like the opposite of good versions of this. Okay, so it's a book organized around anxiety, for one thing. So by the time you're done, you're just decided that your fetus is already dead and deformed. And by the way, you're never going to have your body back. Everything, okay. But more than that, the way they think about risk is the precautionary principle gone wild. So the precautionary principle, if we don't know the danger, then don't take on the danger. And often the precautionary, lots been written about this, is a very good idea. If we really don't know how, if we don't know how to effectively manage nuclear waste, okay, not that we know how to know the risk, but we don't even know what the risk would be, maybe that's a reason not to do nuclear. You can see how these things get very complicated. Okay. On the other hand, let me point out that clinical research is all about managing the precautionary principle. The whole point of clinical research trial, the animating principle behind it is, we don't know, ergo let's study in a scientifically and ethically responsible way. But that animating principle of clinical research collides with this cultural thing around pregnancy where if you don't know, then don't do anything. Let me give an example from that, what to expect. So when I was pregnant with my first child, actually the same time that Brenda was pregnant with hers, so Helen's now 12, John and I were stupid enough to buy a fixer-upper. At the same time that I was pregnant, we both had new jobs. Go figure. So we had to do a ton of work, and including paint the house. Okay, so I got my sister, bad woman, had sent me what to expect when you're expecting. So I look up paint, and I counted the column inches of the worries, the research, that the studies that have been done indicating that paint was terrible. Thinking, well, that got me out of painting at least. Okay, so then I keep going, and then it said, after many column inches, like page and a half of tight. That's for oil-based paint. Oil-based paint, high volatility. You're cleaning up with turpentine, for heaven's sake. Okay. I'm going to do latex. So I keep going. Latex paint. To this day, because, again, this was old, 12 years ago, no studies that we know of have been done on latex, but better to be safe than sorry. And it ended. Okay, so we take scary stuff that we know to be bad, and we juxtapose that with then, we don't know if this is safe, and send everybody on their merry way. Okay. Lest you think this is an old way of thinking. A recent study just came out looking at caffeine usage in pregnancy for risk of miscarriage, early loss. Classic example of this form of reasoning. It was actually a very... I belong to another research group that's interdisciplinary looking at risk in pregnancy that includes epidemiologists and OBGYNs as well as philosophers. Actually, very well done study, well controlled, well designed. And it did find that 3 cups of coffee a day and above increased the chance of early miscarriage by blah, blah, blah percentage. Okay, good to know. It also found that 1 to 2 cups a day was fine. No increase of miscarriage. So I'm thinking, what a great, reassuring news. The headlines should read. Contrary to what everybody's been telling you, it's okay to have a cup of coffee in the morning when you're pregnant, insofar as pregnancy loss is concerned. I won't speak to any other risks because I haven't followed the data recently. Fantastic. And again, mere inconvenience to the woman. Well, again, I mean, some of us, it's a life-sustaining drug. So, and keeps us nice to our other children and husbands and friends. Okay. So a cup of coffee, and that's all I need. Okay. But instead, the study ended with, after doing a beautiful job setting out the methodology and the specific findings, said, ergo, we advise pregnant women not to drink caffeine, not to drink coffee during pregnancy. And the headline was, in the newspapers as they picked it up, another study, pregnant women urged not to drink coffee because of miscarriage risk. We wrote a letter to the editor, okay, which thankfully got published. Okay. This is the reason. We take something that's known to be dangerous and then say, either we don't have knowledge, but ooh, it's scary, or we even have reassuring news of safety, but we ignore it. So there is a distortion of risk reasoning that we take with pregnancy that does, I think, collide with the clinical research program. Okay? It's okay to find out information about the pregnant body if we do it responsibly and ethically. Here's a second big barrier. And, you know, I spoke of an elephant in the room before, and boy, is this the elephant in the room in terms of barriers, liability. So when I was here last year at the NIH, I was talking to a group about this issue, and Rich Gorman, who's here at the NIH and led the charge, amongst others, with getting responsible inclusion of pediatric population research. Okay. It took lots of efforts, legislative efforts, to give pharma and investigators incentives to take a look at kids. Okay, otherwise they're not going to touch them. Why would they? Right, because get clear the incentives for the pharmaceutical industry. If populations are willing to use the drug without any knowledge, right, because we're still using it with kids or with pregnant, why would they take on the liability of including them in their population? Okay, so just from a self-serving point of view, which is their job, it's fine. They have no incentive to study in these ethically complicated populations, but that means that legislatively we need to mandate an incentive. Okay, so he was. I was asking him all these questions. He was giving us great ideas about, you know, similar legislative incentives we could devise. He said, but of course, you know, you've got a bigger problem than we do. And I hated hearing that. So, okay, well, at least with kids, when they enroll in a clinical research trial, you know pretty well, there are always some surprises, the baseline of health they bring to the clinical trial. Okay. But with the fetus, we've got a baseline 3% deformity rate on birth. Just baseline. That's life. They're not all severe. Lots of them are not severe. But it's 3%. So if you enroll pregnant women in clinical research trial, we just know ex ante that 3% of the babies are going to come out with some kind of deformity or medical problem. Okay? I can just see pharmaceuticals running from the room right now. Because how do we set up a legal system that gets methods of determining whether the resultant deformity or difficulty was a result of being in the clinical trial? Do we indemnify the trial, those who do the trial, of all liability? How do we ever suss out, even for the parents? I mean, think of the mother who agreed to be in the trial and then you see your child has cleft palate. Was that because cleft palate happens? Or is that because you were in the trial? And, of course, we know it's very difficult. We all, but population in general, is a very difficult time reasoning about probabilities. The fact that it happened to you doesn't mean it's because of something you did. There's a baseline out there that we tend to ignore. So we need to confront liability issues. The third reason I basically already mentioned, which is the incentives of researchers to even take on this problem. So we really do need some kind of legislative directive. Those three things are going to be really difficult to solve, and it's going to take time. Any ideas you have, I would love to hear from you. But lest I sort of just stop with the depressing version, there are some low-hanging fruit that we could really take on, and this is part of where people like you come into the picture. Because even without taking on the big task of changing regulations or doing liability reform, or, I don't know, little things like changing the entire culture about pregnancy. There are ways in which the individual researchers and IRB members can themselves, in the existing regulatory climate, make significant changes. Having it be a question of why wouldn't we include pregnant women for every study you're doing? Again, often the answer is going to be super quick and easy. There's no need to even get into the difficulty because it's for prostate cancer or something that it's not a direct benefit trial, but it looks like it might have risks. Or pregnant women, this is a medication for an illness that very, very, very few pregnant women suffer from. But to even ask the question and know that you are allowed to have pregnant women included if there's minimal risk to the fetus means that we would start having more pregnant women in And we start then confronting some of the specific issues about what's adequate justification for exclusion and what's not. More generally, I'm here at the NIH, I can lobby just a little bit to you all at least. More funding of the sort that the NIH has just done with that OPRU network that Chris mentioned, which is just path-breaking, and I'm so proud of the NIH for doing this, to do more, just get more funding for opportunistic studies. Remember, those are the sort I said where we just do a blood draw, you're already under doctor's order, so the trial isn't adding any big risk. If there's liability, hey, at least it's on the obstetrics shoulders and not the researchers. Okay, let's use it. But then we start to gather data about which kinds of medications are ones that the pregnant body deals with differently than others, because it won't be all of them. But right now, we looked at a big database reviewing all of the FDA drug approvals up to 1999, and only 6% of them tracked any data about how the drug was metabolized in pregnant women. They weren't even in the trial, but either opportunistically or post-marketing, give some sense of it. That's not adequate data. So to just find out what the pregnant body does would do us a lot of good and help us to pinpoint when we really need to prioritize facing these ethical difficulties and including pregnant women. Also, looking back just at in a sort of public health manner, what are the health burdens of pregnant women? Which are the big ones? Which are ones that have pretty decent older drugs, where we might say we never did study it on pregnant women formally, but we've now had 30 years of, so there's some hypertension drugs now that are just, or Prozac, for instance, where we just have lots of experience using the drug. But if we leave it with the system now, where we don't confront it and then we just let a few generations of women try it out, we won't know enough. And also, let me just remind you, we don't want to simply say, let's just stay with the older drugs, right? That is, let's substitute marketing experience, the length of marketing experience, for clinical research. Because what does that mean? That means pregnant women will be treated, but only with the older generation of drugs, which, of course, sometimes are much better than the latest ones. But sometimes not. And this is one of the things we're seeing now, that when a pregnant woman comes into her doctor's office, she's given a second best drug because it's the one we have longer use of. Pregnant women shouldn't be second-class medical citizens. And their fetuses should be endangered by treating them without any data, but rather guesswork. So those of you at the in the trenches of the ethics of clinical research can actually do a lot to start these conversations and forward ideas that you have to the OPRU. Thank you.
I was wondering if you could say a few words about consent for pregnant women. In the federal guidelines, I found it a little confusing what the motivation was for when they required the father of the fetus to consent to have the woman in the clinical trial. And that would almost seem, and this is an extremely contentious issue, but if there really is a right to privacy in the Constitution, it seems like you could never require parental consent for...
Why don't you just go to one of the most difficult issues? So did everybody hear this? When should we require father's consent for the pregnant woman to participate in the trial? Okay. You're absolutely right that the regulations and description of it is very confusing. That's because it's confused. And it also is a really difficult issue. Okay. So on the one hand, I'm a firm believer, and as somebody who's a feminist, that we need to underscore fathers' rights and standing with respect to their children and not undermine it. Okay? I'm also somebody who thinks that we don't want to make the father a gatekeeper to the woman, pregnant woman, getting adequate medical care. So I don't want the dad to get to second guess what's best for the pregnant woman. in my own view, and by the way, the Institute of Medicine report, its own recommendations was that paternal permission should not be a condition of participation. I would make it a little more complicated, okay? So trials that do offer some, hold out some direct benefit for the woman, that has a leg in her medical care, and so I don't think that paternal permission should be required. If it's what I might think of as an altruistic enrollment, where it's not going to help her, okay, and again, it's already ethical, so we're not worried about huge risks to the fetuses, but still, she's doing it to help future pregnant women and future fetuses, and thank goodness for that. I could imagine, if, again, it's a wanted pregnancy, so we're going to get a child, that the father might be required to get permission. Does he want to volunteer their fetus for this altruistic task? That's, by the way, a controversial stance. Most people just go one or the all or nothing on that. Okay. Yes.
At the beginning of the day, Christine asked us to not hesitate to make a controversial comment.
Excellent.
And I seem to have a habit of doing that here. My comments are based on 30 years of patient care experience at the Cleveland Clinic. I just started here as a trialist at one of our institutes, and this has to do with the need for tort reform,
yes,
which you touched upon briefly. A clinical trial of pregnant women will require a data safety monitoring board to protect the integrity of the data and the safety of the participants, and not many DSMB participants realize that they are not indemnified participating in these trials. Neither their host institution nor the NIH for NIH-backed trials will protect them against lawsuits. There was a core curriculum for program officers in trials in which Dave Demetz, who's no longer here, a famous biostatistician, trialist, said in his offering, which was videotaped, and I was watching the archive, that he no longer participates in NIH-sponsored clinical trials as a DSMB member. His opinion is sought because he's so famous and experienced. He's at Wisconsin now. And the reason is that the NIH refuses to indemnify a part-time consultant. Only full-time NIH employees and other full-time federal agencies are covered by the Justice Department with a tail, which means after employment, the coverage continues for the rest of that person's life.
Okay.
And Dr. Demetz, whom I contacted at Wisconsin, where he is now, says when he is asked to serve for industry trials, he has a contract that he requires them to sign because industry usually indemnifies itself, but not the consultants. So that's a problem. Why is it a problem? Because there are going to be some birth defects.
Right.
And like it or not, just like Jim Carrey's wife will never be persuaded by the abundant scientific evidence against autism resulting from vaccines, she'll never be persuaded. Like it or not, the mother will be looking for somebody to blame, or there'll be an economic burden on a brain-injured child. And to cover that burden, they'll get a plaintiff attorney. So the DSMB members, who may have put a lot of forethought into protecting the safety of the participants, might not have thought of some unforeseen complication. And in the same way that a well-known recent politician bankrolled his political career as a personal injury lawyer suing cerebral palsy baby families, doctors and hospitals, because the jury sided with the brain-injured child, despite the fact it couldn't be proved or disproved, the same dilemma will exist in a brain-injured child in a pregnancy woman clinical trial. And the DSMB members will not be protected. So that has to be dealt with.
very helpful. I was looking for a pencil so I can write it down, and if I can, I'll catch you at the break. And I'll tell you why I find that very helpful, because, first of all, we have to name the constraints and the difficulties we're going to face. We can't be naive about this. But also, when you name them, then you can start brainstorming around it. So my mind was running with potential shifts of, do you have indemnification for part-time DSMB members from the NIH? Should we have specially trained ones who, when dealing with inclusion of pregnant women? But do you see what I mean? Those are specific kinds of policies we could advocate for and deal with. So the more we identify, the better. I very much appreciate that. And I very much agree with your concerns about liability. If I could just make one comment, because I did mention, oh, good, let the OB shoulder the liability concern. And I don't mean to be, well, I did then meant to be facetious, but not in general. A new article just came out with a fabulous title, Who is Going to Deliver Our Grandchildren? Because that is the crisis in obstetrics right now. Liability concerns are running them out of business, and good people who do absolutely nothing wrong. Thank you for your comment. Over here.
Hi, thanks. I wanted to ask you about what you would urge us to do in terms of advocating for political change or even in interpersonal conversations and talking about research on pregnant women, and whether there are limits to what you would encourage us to advocate for. Because as I understand it, historically, pregnant women were excluded, the exclusion of pregnant women linked in with abortion politics in the late 60s and early 1970s. And it seems like there are a lot of resonances now where this is still such a contentious issue. And even thinking in terms of things like health insurance for pregnant women, that gets layered in with issues about the status, the personhood status, yes, and fetal rights. And so I'm wondering what you would encourage us to do in terms of this sort of overarching political issue of the status of the fetus, because it ties in so tightly with issues of research on pregnant women, and it's been historically so contentious.
I'm so glad you brought up this issue. I think I'm now on my third elephant in the room, but abortion and fetal status is another one of them. I think you're absolutely right. I think a lot of people, first, if you say I'm against inclusion of pregnant women or I'm for inclusion of pregnant women in research, they hear you as voting on fetal status. Oh, you're either pro-life or pro-choice. This has nothing to do with the abortion issue, again, for pregnancies that are going to be continued. It turns out there are some complications when we get into earlier pregnancies where sometimes it's unclear whether the pregnancy is going to be continued. It might depend on how the trial goes, right? So I don't want to pretend it away. That is, some women may abort if the DSMB comes back and says, I'm a little worried because some women have a lower threshold than others for aborting. So it's not that it couldn't possibly intersect with the abortion issue, but I do think it's very important to say, in the main, this is orthogonal to the abortion issue and to fetal status. You can think the fetus is a full-fledged constitutional person. You can think the fetus is tissue. You can think something in between, which I think is the right answer. The issue is, if the pregnancy is going to be continued, we're going to have a baby whose health can be affected by what happens in utero. So for that child's sake and the pregnant woman's sake, we need to do research, but it needs to be responsible research. It looked like you had a follow-up.
So it sounds like you're willing to use words like baby and child when talking about an entity that others might consider a fetus. So, I mean, even word choice.
No. So let's be careful with time indexing here. If the pregnancy is going to be continued, there's going to be a baby. There's going to be a child. So you're free to think there's already a baby or child, if that's how you metaphysically understand it. The point is, you can be neutral on what is the status of this entity now. The point is, we're holding in one person used the phrase, a person in prospect, if nothing else. So this gets just into issues about fetal protection policies. Whatever your views on abortion, issues about how pregnant women act during their pregnancy can affect the child's ultimate health. the health of the baby that would be born, everybody can agree on. You shouldn't drink a quart of tequila at night. Not, I can say that. Whatever you think of a fetus right now.
I'll leave it to that.
It sounds like we'll talk. Okay, over here.
I just wanted to say I think it's wonderful that you came to talk about this. This is a really important issue in clinical trials, and I'm really glad this is the first year, I guess, that you've come to talk about this. I had a couple comments. One, I wondered what your thoughts were about the National Children's Study and if you've been following that at all.
I have.
It's sponsored by the NICHD, and they're going to look at 100,000 pregnant women before they're actually going to look at the babies in utero and then follow them all the way through age 21. I can send you an email.
That would
after.
Be fabulous.
So this is with Dwayne Alexander, Dr. Peter Scheidt.
It hasn't started yet, Chris. Okay.
NICHD, and they, I think they're going to start enrolling patients in 2009. So I just wanted to mention that. I think they're going to prospectively follow women, ask questions about what drugs they're taking, that kind of thing. Look at them in utero as soon as they're pregnant, all the way through age 21.
Fantastic.
And then...
So no intervention, just
yes.
Surveillance.
Right,
yeah.
It's surveillance.
Yeah.
And actually, one of the study sites will eventually be Montgomery County, Maryland, which is really interesting. But the other point I wanted to make is, one, it's really cold in here.
It is.
And two, I actually have a really good friend that had a really hard pregnancy, and she suffered from anxiety and depression like your friend Brenda, and she went to one doctor who told her, and I'm quoting this, that Prozac makes delicious babies.
Makes what?
Delicious babies, because they're happy, and she loves Prozac because it makes delicious babies. So then she went to another doctor whose husband actually works for the FDA and said, I'm, you know, really anti-SSRIs, and I think if you could be holistic and, you know, do yoga and eat healthy and walk. So this poor friend of mine had like this two different conflicting information, and she felt like she had to be her own doctor. And like you said, she almost didn't trust anything that anyone told her, and she was walking around like in a bubble, like you can't have lunch meat, you're not supposed to have tuna fish now because of mercury. You know, if you do have lunch meat, you're supposed to heat it in the microwave. Yeah. You know, ridiculous amounts of information.
Yeah.
But so the point that I wanted to make is that I think that we have a lot of information out there, but it ends up, I think, turning to the patient to be like their own advocate. And she ended up not taking anything, suffering. Then she had postpartum depression. But I know that there's the Prozac registry out there. Mm-hmm. But I feel like there is conflicting information because I know Paxil, I think, has been linked to heart defects. And that's an SSRI.
Right.
One of them has been linked to, I think it's like PPN or something like that, a lung function, a permanent lung problem. And it's been linked to SSRI. So it's like you have to weigh the risk with the benefit.
Okay. Beautiful what she just said. You have to weigh the risk with the benefits. And what I worry about now is that we just drop the ball. Because the idea of risk and assessment when it comes to pregnancy freaks us out, freaks pregnant women out and clinicians. We do a lot of, like your description of it being in a bubble, we do a lot of magical thinking, the psychologists call it, around pregnancy. Because the thought of a baby dying is the unthinkable to us, or the baby being deformed by something you yourself did,
right, is
an unthinkable. And what do we do with the unthinkable? We don't think it. And then we do crazy stuff around it. Okay, so instead of being evidence-based and woman-centered, okay, we just do, you know, lots of... if you're ingesting it, it must be bad. And I love your statement about the woman having to be her own doctor because there are these conflicting. And again, the conflict isn't just, well, you know, one trial said this and one trial said that. That's often what patients have to deal with that all the time. It's a real pain.
Or there's small scale studies. Like a woman might read something on PubMed if she's her own advocate. And, you know,
she's
it makes
not
it sound
get
like
analysis, right?
Right? No, and that's what we need. We need, and I think that's what the National Children's Study is trying to do. I mean, we have to have the power. You can't look at a study of 15 patients and then rule out Prozac. And what are the risks to the mom if she's not eating, or she's depressed, or she's not walking, and not gaining enough weight?
Yeah.
that kind of thing.
Exactly. So. And one last example is women who have asthma. Several studies found that they were just all going off their medication because it was a pill. Well, you know, babies actually need oxygen, you know. It's just, so now, you know, one of the other things we need is for clinicians to get those communication skills. This, you're taking care of your baby. So remember to stay on that medication because every pill you take is taking care of your baby to make sure it's strong and gets all the oxygen it needs. Think of how that would have helped your friend. To put it not as, okay, you have to take a poison every day, but I guess it's okay. It's framing it such that this is an act of being a good mother, because that's how pregnant women who are continuing are thinking of everything that's going in their mouth. Thank you.
Thank you.
You have time for one more. Okay, be quick, and I'll be quick. Okay.
There are many oncologic studies which for healthy women which have as part of the conditions and part of the informed consent that should the woman fall pregnant during the course of the study,
yes,
that abortion should be termination of pregnancy should be recommended. And I'm just curious to hear your thoughts on this. And also just in terms of your general recommendations, if there is some stratification in terms of teratogenic risk derived from animal studies, and how that colors the picture in terms of your recommendations in general.
Yeah, on the latter, absolutely. We precisely need to start doing that kind of stratification. And tell me just at once again that I started to think about stratification.
Okay, yeah, particularly I deal with breast cancer studies.
If the pregnancy emerges, right. So that's right, that one of the things you're rightly pointing out is the fact that pregnancy can emerge during a trial. So we're not just talking about guidelines for when I sign you up, are you pregnant or not? It's what if pregnancy emerges. And we do know that there are a lot of trials where we'd want to include women, but we would not want to include pregnant women, okay? So we need to face, well, what happens if you become pregnant? I don't think that changes with what the only thing that changes with what I'm saying is that you don't always need to boot the woman if she becomes pregnant. But there are times when, and of course you would have informed her ahead of time, contracept or don't have intercourse if you're on this study because it's really, really bad. And if you do, we're going to tell you now we would, I don't know that you could recommend termination, but you would say we need to be very, very blunt about it and many women would choose to terminate. So the main thing is you would want to make sure that she has access to neutral counseling and not just, oh, and ooh, by the way, what we said might happen happened. So you can't abandon her at that moment, but... Thank you. Thank you all very much.
Okay, if everybody could sit, we're going to start the last session of today. We're going to talk about another tricky inclusion in clinical research, and that is research involving persons who are at risk for impaired decision making. And to talk with us about that is Dr. Donald Rosenstein, who's a psychiatrist. He was the clinical director of the NIMH until very recently and is now working as a special advisor to the director of NIMH and has unfortunately left us to go to the University of North Carolina, their gain and our loss. So, Donnie.
Thanks, Christine. Is this way too loud because I had to clip it up high, or can you turn it down up there? Can you hear me okay? Okay, I want to start with two comments before I get going in earnest. And the first is, how many of you ever work out in the morning before you go to work? Okay, so you know the rule is that, you know, more times than not you forget something, right? A tie or, you know, a belt or so. This morning I forgot my socks. So I figured if Maggie can talk about, you know, the problem with women's suits, I can talk about the difficulty with this. And so Chris wanted to know if I wanted the, you know, this microphone or stand behind there. And I said, I think I'm going to stand behind there because of this sock thing. And she goes, you think anybody's going to notice? And I said, yeah, you're right. No big deal. At which point Zeke Emanuel comes down and goes, what's with you? What's with the socks? Immediately. So we're done. We can move on now? Okay. Maggie has to run to something, but I asked her if she would stay for a minute because I found that last talk very clear, very interesting, very thought-provoking, and I wanted to start with a comment to try to make a further distinction that is important for the comments I'm going to make in a few minutes with research involving individuals who may not be able to give informed consent. And that has to do with the notion of, is the inclusion of a person in a study scientifically necessary to answer the question in that study? And so while I'm completely in support of the notion that we need to do a much better job of thinking about why women who are pregnant are or are not included in a study, what the risks are, what the benefits long term in terms of a class of individuals who need to have better care guided by data, I think there's an important distinction between whether the study under consideration is a study that is directly addressing a question of relevance to women who are pregnant, or whether the study is of more general relevance and might then generate knowledge that would be good for clinicians taking care of women who happen to be pregnant. And so it cuts a slightly different direction in my comments, because I worry about exploitation. If you bring people into a study who can't give informed consent and you can answer your scientific question without bringing those people into the study, I worry about exploitation. This is different. This is a risk determination, and trying to make sure that you have generalizable knowledge. But there may be circumstances where, as Christine pointed out to me just a minute ago, if you're not careful, you may end up with one or two or three pregnant women in a study, which might be the equivalent of having 100 people in a study and three very rapid metabolizers. And then what do you do with those three folks? So I just wanted to see if you had any comments on the specificity of kind of the study, the scientific question.
Well, I think you look gorgeous first. I think it's sort of a, you know, formal and yet, you know, tweaked at the end there. But I totally agree with you that scientific necessity is a key criteria. And then how we unpack scientific necessity. And the issue with pregnant women, as opposed to often decisionally impaired, can be that the very thing that makes you want to exclude them may be why it's scientifically necessary. That is, their needs are different than the rest of the population, whereas often somebody who's cognitively impaired is not otherwise medically interesting unless you're studying a drug to treat mental impairment. Okay, so more often, pregnant women are going to get in under the scientific necessity criteria than probably cognitively impaired. Thanks.
Thank you. Okay, Maggie's allowed to go now. She's writing on a deadline with an op-ed piece, so keep reading your newspapers. Okay, so here's the question, the core question for the next 40 minutes, is under what circumstances is it ethically permissible to include individuals in a research study when those individuals can't give informed consent? And it's an interesting and an important question. And I think what it does for me is it brings into bold relief many of the core themes that you've been hearing about in this course. The need to advance knowledge, generate data that's going to improve the health and care of individuals versus risks to individuals and potential for exploitation. So what I want you all to think about, which because you're able to do this, is think about how you feel about, how you imagine you would feel about being in a study if you lost the capacity to decide for yourself about that specific study. So if your husband or wife or father or daughter or friend or partner, somebody, was faced with a decision about whether to enroll you in a study, what kinds of things might be of interest to you? And also, what might be going through your mind if you were in the position to kind of make a decision for someone else? So I'm going to take you through a series of slides and examples, and hopefully we'll have a conversation about some of the cases that I bring up. So here's the basic game plan. I'm not going to be talking about emergency research, which is very interesting and very often involves individuals who are decisionally incapacitated. Stroke victims, loss of consciousness, emergency room stuff. There are all sorts of interesting ethical issues, and we just don't have time to talk about that today unless there's a really burning question. But, you know, maybe we can get back to it later. But the scope of this is in non-emergency research with adults. I'm also not going to talk about people under the age of 18. What I'm going to do in just a few minutes is mention three or maybe four quick cases to try to frame some of the issues for our discussion. What I want to do right this minute is just take a few of the terms that are most commonly used in this discussion just to do some definitional stuff. Competence is a legal determination. There is a presumption in most Western societies that adults are competent to make decisions for themselves unless proven otherwise. In the United States, it's a judge who will determine whether or not you've lost competence. Sometimes it's kind of global determination. Sometimes it's for very specific activities like managing your finances, making healthcare decisions, etc. And so very often as a clinical psychiatrist, I would get a call from someone on a unit. A patient may have a confusional state, and my colleague will say, could you please do a competence assessment? And I usually say, well, I'll tell you whether I think they have decisional capacity, the ability to give informed consent for clinical care or informed consent for research, but really it's a judge's determination as to whether someone is incompetent. As a practical matter, in most hospitals, these kind of blur together, and very rarely are people taken to court to kind of be declared incompetent, but I just wanted to make that distinction clear. The second thing is that we all have different skill sets, cognitive and otherwise, and very often people with different neurologic, psychiatric, medical conditions can have a loss of decision-making capacity, a loss of cognitive function that impairs certain abilities but not others. It doesn't always advance on a uniform front. So when people talk about cognitively impaired individuals, you can have some cognitive impairment and still be able to give informed consent for certain decisions. They're not the same thing. And so what I'm going to be talking about mostly is the notion of some kind of medical, psychiatric, neurologic condition that impairs decision-making capacity for the purposes of being able to provide informed consent for a specific research study. It's relative to the decision at hand. That's the point I want to make. This next point about decisional phenomenon and categorical decisions is one that we all struggle with in all of research ethics. So what I mean by this is that, in general, as I mentioned earlier, there can be a whole range of abilities, and you can imagine a continuum where on one end you have someone who's not able to make any decisions whatsoever, and on the other end of the spectrum, you can have someone who is that Ericksonian self-actualized person who kind of gets it all, understands the fine distinctions between clinical care and clinical research. But then there are gradations everywhere in between. But as a practical matter, clinically, very often we have to make a yes or no decision. Similarly, IRBs struggle, as you heard from David this morning, and I'm sure others, with risk determinations that also exist along a continuum, but the federal regulations mandate that we put people into categories of minimal risk or more than minimal risk, or in the case of children, and you have or have not had the pediatric talk yet.
Yes, sir.
Okay, minor increment over minimal risk. These are categorical decisions about fundamentally continuous or dimensional phenomena. This second to last bullet on this slide is the reminder to me to state the obvious, which is that easy cases are easy, hard cases are hard, and it's the ones in between that we all really struggle with. This is why I feel so strongly that for this area, a procedural approach is important. The details matter. Thinking about how the investigators write protocols, how IRBs review them, how investigators conduct them, how data are analyzed and published. That process is where I think the ethical analysis belongs. Because, as you'll see in just a moment, some of these are very difficult decisions to make. At the very end of my talk, I want to turn my attention to two specific additional protections that can be employed when you're studying individuals who either are unable to give informed consent or at risk of being unable to give informed consent. So basically, consent monitoring and independent assessment of decision-making capacity for the purpose of giving informed consent. So for the purposes of our discussion this morning, I hope that not too many of you would have fundamental strong objections to doing minimal risk studies if it was compelling science in individuals who may not be able to give informed consent, if it really is going to answer a question that you think is important. Something like a paper and pencil test, something like a simple blood draw. Those are, in many cases, the easy end of the spectrum. But what I want to do now is talk about three specific studies just to lay out some of the possibilities so you can think about it. So the first case would be an investigator who thinks he or she has a promising new medication for Huntington's disease. So for those of you who are not in medicine, Huntington's disease is a genetic disorder that is pretty awful. And it involves kind of motor, neurologic deterioration, psychiatric symptoms, dementia, and ultimately death. I think it's also fair to say that our current understanding of the pathophysiology is complex, and our ability to treat this disorder is very, very limited. It's symptomatic management only. I think everyone who has known someone with Huntington's disease or carries the gene is dying for something, quite literally and figuratively, that's going to be better, either in terms of symptom management or prolonging the progression of the illness. And so it's hard to imagine that if there was a promising drug that came along that you wouldn't be leaning towards trying it with appropriate protections in individuals who are affected, even if they can't give informed consent. Now, one advantage is that for the most part, in the vast majority of cases, individuals with Huntington's disease were fully capacitated at one point earlier in their life. And what's nice is that they could do what I asked you all to do at the very start of this talk, which is to think about what your own preferences and values are with respect to research participation. So it might very well be that a spouse would come along and say, you know what, I know that my husband was very risk-averse and understood that some of these things just happen, and I don't think he'd want to be in a study, even if it might delay progression of the illness, and so I'm not going to do that. We had conversations like this. Or alternatively, someone might say, I know perfectly well that my wife has suffered so much with this and thinking about this and is so worried about her children and her grandchildren that anything that she could do to try to help advance the state of knowledge is what she'd want to do. So even though this is a phase one trial and it's got promising science behind it, but there's not much of a chance it's going to make a difference, absolutely I want to, you know, provide permission for my spouse to come into the study. So I put this first case up as an example of one that, at least to me, in theory, is not too controversial. The second one is more controversial for me. And when I first read this study several years ago, I thought to myself, woof. So autism is a profound developmental disorder. It impairs communication, speech, learning, social interactions. And one of the things in contrast to the study that I just mentioned is that for many individuals with autism, when they become adults, you may not have the luxury of knowing what their preferences were about how they would feel about clinical research. For some individuals with autism, it exists along a broad spectrum. People can tell you how they feel about it. But for many individuals, the answer is no. And again, our understanding of the pathophysiology is very limited, and we have symptomatic treatments that I can tell you firsthand, having a 16-year-old son with autism, are not very good. So there were some investigators in a couple of different sites a few years ago who had this idea that by studying serotonin metabolism through a dietary manipulation, something called a tryptophan depletion study, where you give amino acids in a certain cocktail, a pretty yucky-tasting milkshake, you can temporarily drop plasma levels of tryptophan, which is a precursor to serotonin, which we have reason to think is involved in some of the behaviors in autism and some of the response to some medications. But I underscore here that these are kind of nonspecific mechanisms. I don't think anybody who is being real straight with you as a scientist would say, you know, that this is a very specific lesion in autism. We just know it's involved. Nancy, would you agree with that? The other point about this study is that I think that it's fair to say that for these kinds of studies, these are pathophysiology studies. You're trying to understand something about the underlying disorder by studying it under dynamic circumstances, but it's not a clinical trial. It's not a prospect of benefit study. So the thing that's not on this slide is that very often the whole point of tryptophan depletion studies is to see an increase in symptoms under study. So whether if it's depression, it's a short-term return of depressive symptoms, if it's obsessive-compulsive disorder, it's a blip in obsessive-compulsive symptoms, and in the case of autism, it's an exacerbation of symptoms. So you have to ask yourself, why would somebody want to do this if they understood this? I'm not going to answer the question, but I want you to think about some of these studies, and then I'm going to take you through what some of the procedural issues are. This is another case. Fragile X is a genetic disorder that affects probably about 50,000 individuals in the United States. Boys are about twice as likely to have Fragile X syndrome as girls. And what the primary defect in Fragile X is the silencing of a gene that's related to protein synthesis, and it actually gets kind of complicated. That's not real germane here, except to say that there are investigators who feel that they have a way of measuring cerebral protein synthesis that's quite specific to some of the problems in animal models of Fragile X. And so in contrast to the last study where the scientific rationale was more general, these investigators feel like they've got a really good lead on the gene product, and how to understand perhaps a way to track treatments through protein synthesis in the brain in individuals with Fragile X. So what's involved in the study? Well, it's going to be adults between 18 and 24. It's expected that most of the individuals, because of the nature of Fragile X syndrome, will not be able to give informed consent. So the expectation is that substitute decision-making, surrogate permission from parents or legal guardians will be how the research is authorized. It's understood by everyone that this is trying to learn about cerebral metabolism, and it's not a clinical trial similar to the tryptophan depletion study, so there's no prospect of direct medical benefit to individuals. And what's involved is an MRI where you have to lie still for a while, a PET scan with low-level radiation exposure, but that involves the insertion of an arterial line under local anesthesia, and the use of sedation to help people stay still while they're getting scans with a medicine called propofol. So this is a really interesting challenge. In my opinion, having read the protocol, the science is very compelling. The clinical need for better understanding of Fragile X and better treatment is very compelling. The risks, everyone can agree, are more than minimal risk. The question is how much more than minimal risk, and how do you think about whether you want to approve this kind of study or not? So I put these out here as kind of the difficult cases in the middle, because fundamentally at the core of this whole topic is a tension that I don't think can be resolved between the need to advance science, because as I think Maggie Little so beautifully articulated last hour, there are risks of not studying disorders. There are risks of exclusion. So there's a need to do better, and there's a risk of taking advantage of individuals who may not be able to make decisions for themselves, and there aren't simple answers about how you're going to do that. So let's talk about process. So I like to think, as I mentioned right at the outset, I like to think about this kind of broken up roughly into different stages. So there's the design and methodology stage. I don't think you can talk about research ethics unless you talk about very specific details about the study. What are the inclusion criteria? Are you bringing in people who have standard manifestations of the illness under study, or are you going to bring in people who have refractory treatment? You know, they'd have failed four or five or six medicines. Are you going to exclude those people who have the most severe form of the illness and only study people, you know, for instance, in the case of Alzheimer's disease or schizophrenia? one of the things that has come up at the the NIMH-IRB recently merged with other brain IRBs into a larger IRB. But in the old days, we used to have very interesting conversations about some of our studies of patients with schizophrenia or autism or dementia. And the discussions went something like, well, why don't you do the study with people who have the milder form of the illness? Because, you know, they can give informed consent and we don't have to worry about this decisional capacity, some of the thinking that you heard Maggie articulate recently. And what the investigators would say is that's going to skew the scientific findings, because if you're only studying one end of the spectrum, you're going to be missing something very important. Now, sometimes that argument was more compelling than others, but my point is that the ethical questions come in right in the beginning in terms of what the investigators think about what the details of the study are going to be. Then the next phase is the IRB review. So one of the things that was a pet peeve for me when I was chairing an IRB several years ago is that we would get investigators who would come in and they'd essentially say, tell me what I got to do to make it ethical. You know, and they said, and they hadn't thought about this fundamental question, because at the IRB conversation we'd say, well, are you going to be bringing in individuals who are not able to give informed consent? And they'd go, well, what do you think? I think that investigators have to think about that question first and make a very definitive argument one way or the other. Now, the IRB doesn't have to agree with that decision, but I think the responsibility is on the investigators to do that first. Then the next phase is, how is the study conducted? Who's going to decide whether someone can or cannot give informed consent? Who's going to decide whether, if they can't give informed consent and the IRB allowed the study to go forward with surrogate permission, whether the person who's providing the permission is doing it for the right reasons? So what are the right reasons? Well, that's a very interesting, longer discussion. And there was someone here who's in the bioethics department a few years back named Dan Brock, and he wrote a wonderful book called Deciding for Others. And to make a very complicated story ridiculously simple and wrong, let me break it down. But in general, people talk about two ways of deciding for someone else. One is called the substituted judgment approach, which is, if I'm deciding for my wife about whether she wants to come into it, whether to have her be enrolled in a study or not, I should, you know, from that perspective, I would try to be thinking, well, what would she do if she were able to make that decision? I'm going to substitute, you know, based on what I imagine she would have done. Not what I would do for myself, but what I think she would have chosen. Other people have argued that what you should do in deciding for others is to use a best interests standards. What's in that person's best interest? Now that I am the responsible person for making decisions for them, my sole concern ought to be what I think is in their best interest, even if I think they might have gone in a different direction. But I can't know that for sure because we never really talked about it. And so there are kind of two different ways to think about it, and there's a bit of a debate. What we do know from data that Dave Wendler and others have published is that people are not very good at knowing what someone else would have wanted. And there's a lot of work to be done in kind of improving our ability to make good decisions for other people. So if nothing else, when you go home tonight and are having dinner with other people in your lives, you may want to have a conversation, not just about research, but about, you know, life-sustaining treatment and other things, because as a general rule as a society, we don't do very well with advanced directives and letting people know how we feel about what we want to have happen to us if we're not in a position to say so for ourselves. The last box here has to do with data analysis and publication, and this is obviously a very important locale for ethical deliberation, and one of the things that Frank Miller, a colleague, and I have been pounding away at for years is that research not only has to be ethical, but it has to appear ethical. And I think that as a general rule, we don't do nearly enough in terms of putting in details in published manuscripts about what our thinking was about whether people, you know, could or could not give informed consent, how that decision was made, what the reasons were for it, and so on. So if you're taking, if you're going to come along with me on this procedural ride for a minute, there are a lot of people who weigh in on each step of the process, and there are lots of regulations that are involved. There are specific laws in some states that regulate research with decisionally impaired folks. California has a law now. There are policies, national policies, local policies. We happen to have one in this hospital if anyone's interested. It's called Medical Administrative Series 87-4, and it was recently revised by a group of folks after a very brief review period of 15 years, was it, Christine? It's a complicated matter. The alphabet soup at the bottom of this slide refers to kind of the different agencies that weigh in on research with people who may not be able to give informed consent. So OHRP, you've probably heard, is the Office of Human Research Protections. That's the federal oversight agency that grants an institution the license to conduct research with individuals, and they're the ones who take it away when you screw up. The Food and Drug Administration oversees the clinical trials with drugs. Very often, in most cases, the regulations are harmoniously tied together, but not in all cases. I mentioned MAS. NBAC stands for the now defunct National Bioethics Advisory Commission. And for those of you with a particular interest in this area, they published a report in 1998 that was entitled something like Research Involving Individuals Who May Be at Risk for Impaired Decision-Making Capacity. And it's a pretty thoughtful, scholarly review that was mostly ignored for the last decade. But it's worth reading, and they came up with about 20 recommendations about research with decisionally impaired folks. Well, this is what the regulatory language includes in this area. When some or all of the subjects are likely to be vulnerable to coercion or undue influence, such as children, prisoners, pregnant women, you just heard about that, mentally disabled persons, that's what I'm focusing on right now, additional safeguards have been included in the study to protect the rights and welfare of these subjects. That's it. Since 1980, this is the extent of the regulatory language involving individuals who may not be able to give informed consent. Now, this is pretty straightforward in one sense. It's kind of motherhood and apple pie. Who could argue with that? If you've got potentially vulnerable folks, do something more for them. But what it doesn't help you with is kind of specifics. Who is it exactly that we're talking about as vulnerable because of a mental disability? Does that mean anyone who has a psychiatric diagnosis? I don't know about any of you, but I've been in psychotherapy a few different times. I carry a diagnosis. I don't think I'm decisionally impaired. And there's been a lot of concern about excessive stigma in this area. Most of the groups that get together and talk about policy approaches tend to be focused on people with significant severe psychiatric illness, schizophrenia, autism, dementia. But these issues, I think, are relevant for all of medicine and all of medical research. Individuals who have central nervous system malignancies, people who get high-dose steroids as part of a clinical trial, people who have metabolic disorders and experience delirium. So I think we need to think broadly about this and not categorically. One of the things that has been really nice about the NBAC report 10 years ago is that even though most people haven't adopted the recommendations, what it did do is it lit a fire underneath a lot of investigators who study individuals who are at risk for impaired decision-making. And we've had a wealth of great studies that looked at this, that looked at decision-making capacity in great detail. Some of those citations are in your background reading. There's a much longer review of those studies that are in the recent textbook that was put out by the Department of Bioethics. Frank Miller and I have a chapter in there on decision-making capacity. So if you're interested in what the data show, you can see that. But the point I want to make is that diagnoses alone aren't real helpful. Study after study now has shown that with adequate informed consent, individuals with schizophrenia can provide informed consent in most cases. that's not a reason to presume that someone won't be able to give informed consent, is one example. So the federal regulations are also silent on what they mean by appropriate additional safeguards. There's no guidance whatsoever. There's now an HHS secretarial panel with the unfortunate acronym of SACARP that is looking at this, and one of the questions that they have been dealing with is whether or not the federal regulations need to be amended or added to have a separate subpart for individuals with decisional impairment. There was an attempt to have a fifth subpart back in the late 70s and early 80s when the federal regulations were written, but that kind of effort was defeated for historical and political reasons. But what SACARP is doing now is they are moving towards not recommending additional federal regulations, but issuing guidance, which would be really nice to put a little bit more meat on the bones of what's in the regulations right now. And I think that ultimately, if you're interested in conducting these studies the best way you can, it doesn't really matter whether there's federal regulations or guidance as long as people are doing what they're supposed to do. So as we kind of work our way across this process, I've mentioned some of these things, and so I'll go a little bit fast. But, the first question has to do with, and this is what I was talking about with Maggie right at the beginning, is do you need people in the study who can't give informed consent to answer your question? Are you specifically studying dementia? Are you specifically studying severe schizophrenia? Or are you doing something else where you can answer the question just as easily with people who are able to give informed consent? So the nature of the study population is going to determine what some of the decisions are, and the nature of the study itself, whether you're going to be taking people off medications, whether you're going to be giving them drugs that may affect the central nervous system. But to this point of is it necessary, this necessity requirement? David Wendler has written, I think, very well on this issue. But as a general rule, I think that most people would say when you're talking about research that does not offer the prospect of direct medical benefit, let's leave aside the Huntington's clinical trial for a minute. But if this is quote-unquote non-beneficial research, my feeling and what a lot of people think is that if it's not necessary to enroll decisionally impaired subjects to answer your question, then you shouldn't. Because one of the things that you lose when you lose decisional capacity is, the ability to change your mind, even if you've lived a life of altruistic acts. Or if you would have wanted to enroll in a study and then you get into it and you go, you know what, this is a much bigger hassle than I thought it was going to be. When you're decisionally capable, you can say, okay, I'm done. I want to leave now. It's harder to do that when someone else is deciding for you. Okay. IRB, what are some of the issues? I've just mentioned some of these. So what might be exceptions to this necessity requirement? Well, one, as I indicated, if there is a reasonable prospect of direct benefit, I think that if I were to have some kind of dread central nervous system illness and there was a promising drug and the only way to kind of get it was to be in a clinical trial and what was available as far as standard clinical care was not so hot, I'd be interested in being enrolled in that study by someone else. Some people have argued that for individuals who live their life this way, wanting to make contributions to science, wanting to make contributions to society, and they've been very clear that they want to participate, even after they've lost the capacity to make decisions for themselves, you can honor their prior values. And in fact, this can be done in a advanced directive where you spell it out explicitly. This can be done in certain longitudinal studies. For instance, We had a study in our institute for many years that involved a longitudinal study of individuals at risk for Alzheimer's disease. And some people would come in at the very earliest stages of cognitive impairment when they were still able to give informed consent. And then predictably, at some point down the road, they would lose that ability. But if you have the conversation from the beginning, they've made a commitment to do this, then you can feel better about maintaining that involvement over time. One of the things that people disagree about for no prospect of benefit studies is whether you should bring people in who to studies that are minimal risk or not. And I'll leave that for you to think about. We can talk about later. So let's talk about risks for a minute, because this is where the rubber meets the road in IRB deliberation. So as you've already heard, there are two categories of risks for adults and three for children. The federal regulations make no reference to this intermediate risk. I happen to be of the opinion that this is a useful framework to apply to adults who are decisionally impaired, and I've been able to convince some of my colleagues, and that's how 87.4 was rewritten with this intermediate category, and I recognize that it's not a perfect solution, and I'll talk about that right now. There are a lot of data that suggests that IRBs tend to be conservative in their risk assessment. And one of the worries that people have is that if you only have two categories of risk for adults who are incapacitated, that you might lean towards saying, if this study doesn't hold out the prospect of direct benefit to an individual subject, and it's more than minimal risk, we don't want to be in the business of doing that. And I think that's a legitimate position. But not all risk that's more than minimal risk is the same. I think I got this next slide. So you can think about, you can argue with me about where these are, but I'm just basically giving a sense that a simple blood draw is minimal risk. Everyone agrees on that. A brain biopsy is not. These kind of anchor the decision. And if you think about kind of doing a go, no-go decision, IRBs draw the line here very often, and they'll say, you know what? An arterial line, that's just not minimal risk. And we're not comfortable with arterial lines in no prospect of benefit research with decisionally impaired folks. So you can't do that kind of stuff. Even though it's not nearly as risky as some other procedures. So one practical, pragmatic approach that we took in the revision of 87.4 was to say, even though the risk categorization in children is far from perfect, and IRBs can't really agree on what minimal risk is, let alone what a minor increment over minimal risk is. For almost 30 years, IRBs have been using that framework, and I think more times than not, they've gotten it right. In the tough case, there's a mechanism for appeal for the really tough cases, but it has provided some flexibility for very compelling studies that don't comfortably fit in that minimal risk category. So that would be this yellow bar. And again, where the lines are aren't important. What I'm trying to suggest is that if you're thinking about that Fragile X study, would anybody want to argue that an arterial line, a PET scan, and sedation with propofol is minimal risk? It's not. Is it so risky that you wouldn't want to allow a parent who is informed to enroll their child, their adult child, into that study because they think that this is going to add to the body of research? So we took this stance because we wanted to try to help IRBs struggle with these intermediate risk categories, and I'll be curious to think whether you think this is a good approach or not. I have a couple of minutes, so I just want to go back for 1 second to make it, because there was a really interesting question that someone asked either David, maybe David Wendler after his talk, about kind of understanding the difference between kind of direct medical benefit and benefit to society. I think this is one of the most interesting issues in all of research ethics, and one of the funkiest kinds of calculus that IRBs have to do. Because it's real, when there's direct benefit to subjects, you can think about whether that the risk benefit analysis makes sense for a given individual. What are the risks to that person? What are the potential benefits to that person? And you kind of say, let's assume that it's going to be a valuable study. But when you're talking about a study that doesn't offer the prospect of direct benefit to subjects, that's weird. You're balancing risks to an individual, and this was relevant for Maggie's talk as well, to benefits to a class of individuals and future subjects. IRBs do that, but it's not easy. Research subjects do that, and it's not easy. Surrogate decision makers do that, and it's really not easy. And then the only other point I wanted to mention is that some people find that even if it's a study that doesn't offer the direct prospect of direct benefit to subjects, they get personal benefit from doing good. And that doesn't come into the equation very often. All right, I want to make a couple of more comments, and then I'm going to stop because we're late. This is one that I'm completely compelled to make every year. I'm a psychiatrist and a clinician. I'm not a philosopher and I'm not an ethicist, but some of my very best friends are. And one of the fights that we have, healthy fights over time, has to do with this determination of whether someone is able to give informed consent. Is this a moral determination? Is this a clinical determination? Who should be doing these assessments? Should this be a clinician? Should this be an independent ethicist? Should this be a team of people who have different perspectives, which is the direction that we're going in? But I think that this question has two important components, and they need to be answered in this order. The first one is, does the person in front of you have something wrong with them, either temporarily or long-term, that interferes with their ability to understand, appreciate, and reason with respect to a specific study? Because if the answer is yes, that should trigger all sorts of other questions. Can you fix it? Can you replace electrolytes? Can you use symptomatic management with medicines? Can you treat the underlying disorder? That's a clinical judgment. Sometimes the answer is yes, sometimes the answer is no. Once you ask and answer that question, the next part of it is, well, can this person give informed consent and ought they be enrolled in this study? That's a moral determination, an ethical judgment, and I think they're both components of it. But I worry sometimes if we jump right to the ethical determinations and we kind of just take for granted that someone has decided, yes, someone, you know, there's something wrong with someone's decision making, we might miss an opportunity to help. None of the bioethicists I talk to argue with that. They say that's fine, but that's somebody else's job. Okay. We're running out of time because we got a little bit late. So I just want to make three other points. The first is that of all the different methods that people have used to try to address the assessment of decision-making capacity, the framework that I think is the best one is one that was put together through the MacArthur Competence Assessment Consortium that was led by Paul Applebaum and Ted Litz and others. And they divided decision-making into four domains. And these were basically drawn from competence criteria from every state in the United States. The first one is, do you understand the factual information that's been given to you? What's the purpose of the study? What tests and procedures are going to be done? What are the risks? What are the possible benefits, if any? Factual information, which is distinguished from appreciation, which is kind of the, do you really get it, though? Because you can explain to people that there's a 50-50 chance you're going to get placebo in this study. But sometimes if you ask them what's going to happen, they may say something like, my doctor is going to find the right medicine for me. Yeah, I know that there's a 50-50 chance of placebo, but it doesn't kind of hit home in a sense. There's a lack of appreciation about how the details of that study pertain to your own situation. Appreciation is a more subtle concept. Many people I've met over the years have good understanding and poor appreciation. Many investigators I've met over the years have good understanding, poor appreciation about some of these distinctions. And this is something that folks are really working hard on to try to measure better, to understand better and measure. This is where the therapeutic misconception lives, where people tend to view activities in research as being motivated by personal health care type decisions. Finally, can someone give you a reason for why they're making a decision? And then the last one is there an ability to express a choice? So these are the last, this is the last slide, and I just want to mention that there are, I think, two important and frequently used additional protections for individuals who might be at risk of impaired decision making. One is to have someone observe an informed consent conversation. There's some very interesting, provocative, I think, data that suggests that having a third person in the room can increase someone's understanding and appreciation of an informed consent document. Now, maybe that's because the investigator takes his or her time and does a better job. We don't really understand why. But it's a protection for individuals who may be confused on it, so that if someone who's monitoring that conversation can say, did you understand what the investigator just explained? Sometimes that can facilitate it. And another additional protection is the idea of having someone who does not have a vested interest in the study do an evaluation of whether someone can give adequate informed consent for study or not, so-called independent capacity assessment or independent assessment of ability to give informed consent. And one of the things that we're doing, that the Office of the Clinical Director and the Mental Health Institute is doing, along with the Bioethics Department and our Human Subjects Protections representatives in our institute and anyone else in the clinical center who's interested, is we're trying to put together a team that's going to do these kinds of evaluations for studies that involve very vulnerable subjects or high-risk interventions, which I think is a good protection for the subjects, it's a good protection for the investigators, and it's a good protection for the institution if you have someone who doesn't have a vested interest saying, yeah, this person gets it, or they don't, but since they don't get it, the IRB said that they can have someone else sign them up. We've talked with the person who's signing them up, and we're comfortable with that. So let me stop there and take some questions. Thank you.